You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Elliot Adams. Elliot was an Army paratrooper, infantry in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, and Alaska, and became a leading peace activist, was a national president of Veterans for Peace some years back, and has been leading various peace efforts in the United States and outside of it. He has conducted nonviolence and social movement trainings for organizations like Fellowship of Reconciliation, School of America's Watch, Peacemakers of Schoharie, if I'm pronouncing that right, Student Environmental Action Coalition, War Resisters League, etc. And he currently works with the Meta Peace Team and is co-chair of Creating a Culture of Peace. We will ask him about that. He has taken three trips, I guess, two just in the past 2 years, to the West Bank and is just back from a couple of months in the West Bank, and we will ask him what's happening there. Elliot Adams, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
David, it's wonderful to be on your show. You do such great work. I really admire the work you do.
And I know you've got a little bit of a cold. I appreciate you coming on anyway, and I appreciate all the work you've been doing. What did you see on your most recent trip to Palestine?
It's hard. It's hard to see the oppression at all kinds of faces. It's communities that were in, like Falun, where I spent time documenting the houses that have been demolished and the houses that are to be demolished. And it's just amazing to see houses all around the whole community and wonder how a community can survive on that. In many of these houses, they build the house. You know, they spent their life getting ready to build this house and build a new house. And then the Israeli government says, oh, no, we're going to demolish it. And they had no way of knowing ahead of time it was going to get demolished when they built it. So it's hard to understand, for example, how that community just survives in this. And then there's a whole bunch of houses which are not being, another group of houses which is not being demolished, but that's only under the condition that they, one, don't live in it, two, don't finish it, and three, don't work on it, which is kind of like demolition too. So that's one of the faces we saw. We were in nearby, over in Tukaram. We were at Kadura University. We had heard that the Israeli army had been attacking the students, and we went there to try to quantify what we were hearing and found that, you know, probably, I would say while we were there, on the average, 5 out of 7 days at the university, the Israeli army would come on the campus and would literally shoot people. You know, I was in the cafeteria one day, and the tear gas drove us out. We were at an art exhibit, tear gas drove us out. It was just amazing. The executives of the university said, the administrators of the university said, well, you know, we are the only university in the world that has a military training base on campus. And there is this facility right next to the campus. But when I went to look at it, I found two things. First of all, it's complete. There's nothing there. There's not a single window in anything there. There's not a door there. There's not a roof to keep rain out. So it's obviously abandoned, sort of nothing. And when I looked at the maps, the UN does not record it as a military anything. But it's right next to the campus. And as I say, maybe 5 out of the 7 days of the week, the soldiers go there and start attacking the university. Oftentimes they come right up the middle of the university and shooting tear gas, percussion grenades, rubber-coated steel bullets, real ammunition, and it's just amazing. And as the administrator said, you know, how can we, you know, we're supposed to be creating an environment for education and for people to learn. Now, it seems that by the time we left and we tried to get a lot of publicity for it, it seems that has stopped. But still, it's just appalling.
And what explanation, Elliot Adams, if any, did the Israeli military or the Israeli government offer for such behavior?
They offer none. The university has applied many times to try to say, okay, what's going on here? The university at one point brought in a front-end loader to level off these berms that the soldiers are attacking from. Since it's an abandoned space and it's not listed as any kind of a military base. And the Army confiscated the front-end loader, held the assistant dean for like four or five hours, threatening to arrest him, but gives no explanation for why they're doing it. No explanation for what. And I'm going to be honest. I'll be honest. I looked at it and trying to figure out what they're protecting, you know, why they're, you know, are they afraid the students are going to attack them? Trying to figure out what it is. And as best I can see, it's just plain a training exercise, just a place to put soldiers and train them.
I just am wondering what the response is from the students, because it seems designed to produce fear and rage. I live by the University of Virginia, and I think it was last year the police, baselessly beat up one young African American student, and people took to the streets and marched and protested in front of the police station and raised hell about it. What sort of response is brought on by these Israeli military attacks on a campus?
Well, it is similar that students all get out and young men from around the city come down and they throw some rocks at the soldiers to try to keep them back or to not just stand there and do nothing. They do what, you know, and the result is that, you know, we tried to document the injuries. So I would go to the emergency room, and you know, there's actually two, and try to document the injuries because we wanted to actually quantify what was happening. And I would say on an average attack, there would be 20 to 30 people who would be treated for gas inhalation. These are students. And there would be like eight, you know, depending on the day, but I'm trying to average it, eight of them actually shot, usually in legs and hands and stuff. But just unbelievable.
When the Israeli military is compelled to give some sort of statement to various atrocities, it typically blames it all on the people throwing rocks. Does the throwing of rocks actually keep the soldiers back and prevent violence, or does it serve as a justification for it?
I guess neither. On the one hand, I've watched a number of demonstrations where where the students are throwing rocks. No, let's leave Kadori for a while and go to some of the other places. So for example, up in Kufa to Kadun, there's a situation where two settlements were put between Kufa Kadun and Nablus, and then the military shut the road off. Now, this meant that the people in Kufa Kadun could no longer, instead of going 5-10 minutes to or 10 minutes to Nablus, it took them 45 minutes to go around. And when I was in the ambulance with some injured people, I was told, look, we've had people die in the ambulance while we're getting there because we have to go way all over the place to get there. So there's regular protests. There's weekly protests. In fact, it's actually now biweekly protests trying to say, you know, we got to get this road open. So in that case, you know, you can only throw a stone so far. Typically, the Israelis, if they're trying to defend the soldiers from the rocks, first of all, the rocks are wildly inaccurate all over the place. Secondly, you know, the rocks are just little rocks coming down out of the air, and you got a helmet, and you got a jeep, and you got a tank or whatever you want. So it's like these are not very threatening, but they could easily hold people back with gas. I've watched times when so they could, because gas is tough. So you fire the gas out there and you push it back. And once the gas clears, they're probably going to come back again. And you fire gas, and you could keep them. You could easily keep them out of stone throwing range with just gas. But I've watched situations in Kufa Kadun a number of times where they, from the best I could see, they intentionally didn't use gas so that the demonstrators were coming closer so they could shoot them. And I've gotten videos of soldiers, Israeli soldiers, for example, one on each side of a jeep, sitting there with scopes on the end of their M16s, searching for targets. in a situation where they could perfectly have easily just fired a little bit of gas and pushed the demonstrators out of stone range. But if they did that, they'd push them out of shooting range.
You know, a lot of the weapons of the Israeli military are courtesy of U.S. taxpayers, gifts from the U.S. government. And it was rather stunning this past year to see the Israeli government demand that deal with Iran about nuclear weapons be killed, and the billionaires demand it, and have the U.S. government say no. I mean, it looked like saying no to the Israeli government about something which I can't recall previously, which seemed to raise the possibility that maybe the U.S. government could say no more free weapons next year. Am I dreaming? Is that possible?
I think you bring up two things. One is I just want to tell a little vignette about that issue of us supporting what's happening there. I was trying to get up into an olive orchard to help pick olives, and the soldier was keeping from, so I was talking to him and getting him to get a supervisor, et cetera. But I started talking to him about his weapons, because they're all weapons which I have carried. And suddenly he said to me, oh, yes, my weapon is American, my ammunition is American. He turned around and said, my Jeep is American. And then he looked at me and said, you know, even my boots are American. And it suddenly made me realize that as Americans, or as an American, I have a real responsibility for what the Israelis are doing here, because I'm making it, you know, I'm funding everything. And you bring up this question of why, or whether we could stop, or whether we could say, look, no more funds until you stop the settlements, and the settlements are appalling. And of course we could, but it comes down to the old issue of politics. Our government will bend to the biggest pressure, and certainly, we know that the AIPAC and the Israeli lobby in the U.S. is very powerful. The Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, has told our government and our president to shut up and quit bugging them and leave them alone and so forth and so on. But apparently, I think it is because the American people in general aren't giving the political support for standing up to Israel that is necessary. So there are some Jews who vote on what the government does in Israel, but most of the rest of us who may not agree with what is happening in Israel don't vote on that issue.
So is it accurate, Elliot, to say that AIPAC put everything into killing that Iran deal? But because there was such publicity around it and such public awareness and demand, among other factors, that it went through anyway?
Yes, I would agree with you 100% on that. I think it is absolutely true. And I think that AIPAC is furious about it. And I think that the whole fear of Iran is fueled by Israel. And I think we have to understand that, it's hard to imagine, but you know, all of the young congressmen and senators are taken to Israel and wined and dined and fed the Israeli story. Lots of our generals are taken to Israel and wined and dined and fed the Israeli story. Lots of our police chiefs and police officers are taken to Israel, so they have a conscious and deliberate process with our funds. Of bringing people from the U.S. to bringing officials from the U.S. and indoctrinating, I think the wrong word, but making sure that they understand what the Israeli theory on them is.
But it seems that on the case of that Iran nuclear deal, that the side of peace and justice had a U.S. president and prominent members of one of the two mega political parties in the United States on the right side, at least for once, sort of momentarily, and that was an enormous help. in terms of the settlements and the occupation and the constant violence toward Palestinians. There's not a president in the White House. There's not a president. There's not a presidential candidate in either major political party. How will BDS, will boycotts, divestment, and sanctions advance the cause to the point where we have some power in Washington, or what might do it?
Well, I think you bring up a good point, David. I think that this issue that people can make the change. And we have made the change, and frequently we, or throughout history, we have the people have gotten themselves together and made a big issue about something, and the government changes. So I think that that's there. I think BDS, I don't know if people are aware of it, but that's boycott, divest, and sanction. I think it is a powerful tool. And it's well worth just looking at every product before you buy it and make sure it's not Israeli. And I think, I'll be perfectly honest, I think that helping Israel get out of the situation they're in is really necessary for the survival of Israel. It will not survive this continued occupation. And it's got itself kind of into a box, because it was looking for, for a long time it was the land-based aircraft carrier in, that's what they called itself. Not that we need the land-based aircraft carrier in the Middle East, but that's sort of what it did, and that's why it stayed important to the Western world. And then 9/11, it was looking for a new claim for why it was important to the Western world, and it settled on terrorism and said, okay, we are at the center of terrorism. We are the most knowledgeable people in terrorism. So it's now got itself in this box that if it stops the conflict with Palestine, then it sort of no longer has a value and no longer has a place. And then, of course, with Netanyahu, the racism and the hate that he promotes is what keeps him in office. So they're sort of in a box. And if we really care about Israel, we need to sort of help them. We need to help them get out of that. And as you say, we give them $3 billion a year in just military aid. They are the big. They receive the most aid from the U.S. that any nation in the world receives, so we basically fund them. So I think we do have both the power and the responsibility to help our politicians understand that we need to stop this. We can't morally or actually legally keep supporting what is happening there. And from an international point of view, and from a point of view of, sort of, for example, protection of our soldiers and our money on war, there is no question that that a lot of the conflict in the Middle East comes from our position in Israel. And as I remember an Arab telling me 2 years ago, Israel's not the problem. Israel is just the spear point of the U.S. crusade against Arabs. And that's not an uncommon thing. And I will say that the attitude that I saw this year towards the U.S. was measurably in the West Bank and in Arab countries was measurably different from what it was last year. So already people last year would say, oh, you're from the U.S. U.S. is wonderful. And then they might say, we don't really like the government, but we like the people. This year, there were people who would sort of walk away. And they heard from when I was from the U.S., people would say, we hate your government, but, we like the people. So it was a measurable change of more animosity to the U.S. from last year to this year.
Why? What do you credit that to?
Our behavior, our continued fueling of wars in the Middle East, our continued funding the occupation and the aggression of Israel. Sooner or later, people begin to say, wow, you know, the image of America on the TV is one part, but what they're doing is something else.
Yeah, we're speaking with Elliot Adams, who's a former national president of Veterans for Peace in the United States and a leading peace advocate. Elliot, I assume most people are up on Washingtonian euphemisms, but you said that we need to help Israel, and you said that we're giving Israel more aid than any other country. Of course, the aid is not aid at all. It's weaponry that's making things worse, and the we is not we at all. It's the United States military. But you're over there with something called the Meta Peace Team, engaged in nonviolently intervening to help things. Can you tell us what that team is and what you do to help?
Sure, I'd love to. And David, the Meta Peace Team is a peace team, and essentially the concept behind the work, which is we call TIPNI, Third Party Nonviolent Intervention. That's Third Party Nonviolent Intervention. Essentially, the idea is that conflict is normal. There's nothing wrong with conflict. Conflict is part of life. Conflict is what gives me permission to be an individual. If we're going to support diversity, we're going to have conflict. The problem is the violence of conflict. And we feel like conflict is not inherently involve violence. Any conflict can be dealt with without violence. So, and that third-party individuals can help other people in conflict avoid the violence. So sometimes when people are in conflict themselves, they have a hard time not escalating into violence. But third-party individuals can play a role in reducing that. So that's the work we do.
And
a lot of, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, you go ahead.
Well, I just say a lot of the work is sort of the four main tools that we use, although you use anything you can imagine in any occasion. But the main tools you use are protective accompaniment, so that oftentimes by having another person or a group of people around somebody, they can be protected. A classic example we all remember is in Central America. It was clear that if there was an international, a person from outside the country with a alternative candidate, they just didn't get assassinated as quickly. So protective accompaniment, positioning yourself between the aggressing parties, which obviously takes a little care and thought ahead of time, observing and monitoring so that so, for example, in the West Bank, some of what we did was just to record the violations of international law, report them to the UN, and it's oftentimes for making yourself obvious. So, for example, one of the gates where the soldiers would open the gate, in this case, the wall was put between where the farmers lived and where their farm was. So in order to get to their farm every single day, they had to go down to the apartheid wall and get them to open the gate and let them out to do their farm work, and then in the evening they open the gate and let them come back in. But the problem is there's a tendency for the soldiers to go up whenever they feel like it. So the gate is supposed to be open from 7 to 7:30, but the soldiers may get there at 6 or 6:30 and open the gate, and whenever all the farmers who are present have gone through, they'll close the gate. And the soldier, the farmers who thought they were going to get there at 7 o'clock to go through the gate can't do it. The result is you go at the gate and these farmers have been standing there since 4 o'clock in the morning, waiting for the gate because that's what they have to do. So we would make our presence very obvious there, so they would say that the soldiers would see us there, and we'd say, "Well, we're here, man. We're just recording when you open the gate, when you close the gate, to be sure that you know." And in fact, it made a difference. The soldiers would stand there, and nobody be around, and we'd be. Spent time when I would be standing there, and the soldiers would be the only people around, because I was watching my watch; they were watching their watch. So that's observation. Makes a difference. And of course, modeling is also another part of this tool. And this is work which can be done internationally, but it's also work that can be done in communities. one of our chapters, one of our teams, we aren't chapters, one of the teams which we've trained and set up, looked around the community and said, oh, you know what? We have students who are going through, who are going to school, young, you know, elementary school kids who are getting their lunch money taken from them and who are being bullied on the way to school. So we can show up in the morning. It's the same thing, something we also did in the West Bank, and pick up the students and walk with them to their school just to make sure they get there safely. And they also found that there were elderly in the city who were targets for theft when they went to cash their Social Security checks because they're old people and everybody knew exactly what day they were going to get their check and they're going to cash it. So they started to come to them for that. So it's work what can be done in the U.S. And we also do work at a lot of demonstrations where there's likely to be conflict, like KKK rallies, to try to keep the violence out of the conflict. The conflict's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. That's how we resolve issues. So that's the work of Tiffany and or Third Party Nonviolent Intervention, or Meta Peace Team is one of the teams that does that. It is a road which can move us towards peace because it can help keep the violence out of conflicts. And if you can keep the violence out of conflicts, the conflicts are fine.
It's wonderful work, Elliot, and you've been doing wonderful work for years. Where can people find out more? How can they keep in touch and follow what you're doing?
Well, Meta Peace Team, that's an META Peace Team, has a website, metapeaceteam.org, and that's one place you can follow the work. And in fact, you can look at there. If you go through to the international teams, you can see our blog and see reports we did on a almost daily basis of the various things that we were reporting on each day, trying to keep a record of some of the things we were seeing and helping people understand it. Obviously, Veterans for Peace is an important organization, and veteransforpeace.org is another one we work with. David, you put up a lot of very important information, very important for all of us in the movement because you get the truth out there. So all of your websites, and I can't go beyond without also mentioning World Beyond War, which I use frequently. I gotta just tell you this if you have time, David. I when people ask me, like sales clerks ask me, is there anything else I can do for you today? I usually say, well, we can stop war, and almost invariably I get a positive answer.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's really great. You know, it's all too bad we can't do it, or I wish we could, or can we? And I always refer them to World Beyond War because that is a way of giving them the longer argument, which I don't have time to do at that moment. And World Beyond War is a great, great tool for helping us do what we need to do, which is abolish war.
I wish, Elliot, we had another hour to go into it right now, but we don't. Elliot Adams, thank you so much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. Thank you for all your work. I really appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. politicians and media talk about immigration all the time. But unless Thomas Friedman meets a chatty cab driver, we don't very often hear from immigrants themselves, and rarely at any length or with much substance. That's a problem in its own right, of course, but that invisibility also makes it much easier to demonize immigrants, particularly the undocumented, and to tell stories about the role of immigration in U.S. history that simply aren't true. This set of issues was forced into the daylight at the Boston Globe recently when a labor disruption by the paper's deliverers – yes, lots of people still get the physical newspaper – broached the dividing wall between reporters and the people whose difficult and undercompensated labor brings those reporters' work to much of the public. The story was recounted by Professor Aviva Chomsky. She teaches history and is coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Chomsky is author of the books Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and They Take Our Jobs, and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. Her article, All the News That's Fit to Print, How Media Hide Undocumented Workers, appeared on TomDispatch.com. That conversation with Aviva Chomsky is coming up, but first, we'll take a look back at recent press. Whatever you think of the Bernie Sanders candidacy, it's driven elite media to some serious pearl-clutching that serves to illuminate the core values those media represent every day, election or no election. So we have David Brooks, the voice of sensible republicanism at the New York Times and on the PBS NewsHour and NPR, declaring in his February 9th Times piece that he misses the traits of character and leadership possessed by Barack Obama. Brooks doesn't like Trump's or Cruz's hatefulness, but what bugs him about Sanders is that he's, quote, so blinded by his values that the reality of the situation does not seem to penetrate his mind, close quote. That's unlike Obama, who promotes his values, quote, as much as he can within the limits of the situation, close quote. Pundits like David Brooks rarely take time to excavate who gets to determine the limits of the situation and whether or not that right is justifiably obtained. Instead, we're encouraged to embrace the status quo, which Brooks says, if we were only honest, we would acknowledge is pretty darn good. Sanders, Trump, Carson, and Cruz alike, Brooks writes, wallow in the pornography of pessimism. They'd have you think the country's on the verge of complete collapse, when in reality, quote, we have problems, but they are less serious than those faced by just about any other nation on earth, close quote. And that's the real tell. Brooks looks at a country with the most pronounced income inequality among wealthy nations, the largest trade deficit in the world, the highest gun-related murder rate in the developed world, a place where 1,000 people were killed by police last year compared to one in England and Wales, an infant mortality rate higher than Slovakia or Guam, not to mention Japan and Iceland, life expectancy worse than Lebanon or Greece, and moving in the wrong direction for one sector, middle-aged white people, largely due to increases in suicide, opiate overdoses, and cirrhosis. And Brooks sees a place where people with complaints should recognize that those complaints aren't serious. Well, you could note that that's less than surprising for a journalist who wrote recently about a luxury world tour he took and how it was hard to decide whether to have a second bottle of free champagne. But we should also be mindful of letting people that blinkered serve as arbiters for the merits of resigning oneself to the limits of the situation. Last week, Counterspin talked about conflicts of interest in coverage of the food industry. We were talking then about academics who take money from agribusiness being quoted by media without that disclosure. But sometimes it's the reporters themselves that raise concerns. Tamar Haspel is a food columnist at The Washington Post, but as Stacey Malkin writes for Fair.org, she also does a fair amount of paid speaking gigs for industry interest groups, including those promoting genetically engineered foods. That financial relationship is not always disclosed to readers, and its acknowledgement might help them process work like the column Haspel wrote in late January, in which she said that the surprising truth about the food movement is that there really isn't much of one at all. Most people, she says, don't really care about labeling GMOs. Her proof is that while polls routinely show that if you ask people if they want GMOs labeled, upwards of 90% say yes. But if you just ask them what they would like to see identified on labels, only 7% volunteer GMOs. At which point you are presumably meant to say, aha. Well, one of the surveys Haspel cites to support this comes from the International Food Information Council. That's a group supported by the food, beverage, and agriculture industries, though she doesn't spell that out. They rely on a survey designed by a professor from North Carolina State, Thomas Hoban, who himself is not totally keen on how his work is being used. Since the majority of people just don't know very much about GMOs, Hoban says, the findings don't so much say that they don't care about them as that the government needs to do a better job educating people about what's in their food. One might add that journalists could help with that education effort rather than pretending that the lack of awareness equals wholehearted acceptance. Finally, Americans are divided in many ways, but there are some points of convergence, one of which seems to be hatred of the cable company Comcast. Notoriously terrible customer service, a pricing system described as absurd, a stranglehold on internet speeds, all of that garners the cable company a remarkable amount of dislike and distrust. And that played a role in quashing its effort last year to merge with perennial runner-up for worst company in America, Time Warner Cable. You would think, therefore, that it would be bigger news that Americans who hate Comcast, largely for reasons related to its bigness, are now facing the possibility of essentially another Comcast. The harms from a possible merger between Charter Communications, Time Warner, and Bright House Networks were detailed in a piece for BillMoyers.com by Michael Copps. He's not a stranger to the issue, but the former chair of the FCC, and Copps says that this new mega company would control about a third of the nation's cable and cable broadband markets, would also own programming, including regional sports networks, and would dominate some of the biggest media markets like New York and Los Angeles. Worse, since the new company wouldn't compete in any markets with Comcast, they'd have no incentive to compete, but every incentive to coordinate against shared competitors, including those offering independent and diverse voices. Least surprising, the deal would start the new company off with some $27 billion in debt, a time-honored incentive to raise prices and cut services. And why not? Because where else will people go? Well, there's still time to speak out against this Charter merger. One place you can file comments with the FCC is nomoremergers.com. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The Boston Globe's decision to contract out its subscriber delivery service to a new company that said they could do it cheaper was the kind of business call made every day. And media usually treat such events as just that, business news for the business page. But those decisions have human impacts, too, sometimes huge ones. It's just that the lives they change, generally speaking, aren't the ones that make the paper. Something different happened at the Globe, though, at least for a little while. Our next guest tells the story in an article for Tom Dispatch called All the News That's Fit to Print. Aviva Chomsky is professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. She's author of the book Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and also They Take Our Jobs and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. She joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome to Counterspin, Aviva Chomsky.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, the story you tell in the article is emblematic of a number of things. So let's just start in. The Boston Globe changes their delivery contractor, and what happens?
In a way, not to be too historical, but I think we have to start before they change delivery carriers with how newspapers are delivered at all in today's United States, because I think a lot of people still have in mind that newspapers are delivered by 12-year-olds on their bicycles, and that's not how it is at all anymore. Newspaper delivery has become big business, and it's done through an elaborate system of subcontracting, and the people who deliver the newspapers are adults. They do it by car, and their routes are far longer and more complex than what the kids in the neighborhoods used to do. So newspaper delivery is a job that's done through subcontracting. It's a 365-day-a-year job. It has to be done in the middle of the night from about 2 a.m. until 6 a.m., no matter what the weather, what the conditions. And it's a job that's extremely poorly paid. That is, you have to have your own car, your own insurance. You have to drive hundreds of miles a week. But you're not considered an employee. You're considered an independent contractor. And therefore, the employer, which is the subcontractor, who is contracted by the newspaper, doesn't have any of the responsibilities that an employer has. They don't have to pay you minimum wage. They don't have to give you unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, Social Security. They get out of all their responsibilities as an employer.
Right.
And not surprisingly, this is an area of the economy where a lot of the people who work there are immigrants, and a significant number are also undocumented, because it's designed to be a sort of a hidden underground piece of the economy. So that's how it's been. But then the Boston Globe decided they wanted to make it even cheaper for themselves, and they contracted out to a new delivery company that promised to give them a lower rate. And basically the only way to get a lower rate is to pay your workers even less.
What we would call cutting labor costs in the mainstream media, which
yes,
means
exactly.
Paying workers less who are already relatively very low paid or underpaid.
And there is something just a little bit ironic about this whole situation, that this is the newspaper, this is the people who are supposed to be doing the investigation and bringing the news, and that they're relying on this very hidden system of distribution.
It's actually kind of core to the story. I actually wanted to point out earlier for those folks who think, well, but nobody gets a print paper anyway, that 56% of Americans still read the newspaper in the hard copy. So let's move away from the idea that everybody's just reading it online. And then, yes, this is a business that you think is about transparency and about uncovering, and yet a core part of the industry itself is largely unseen. Well, the story that you write is actually about the broaching of that division, because what happens is that when the contract changes, workers are laid off. The new workers are not just getting paid less, but facing worse conditions. And there's actually a disruption in delivery. Is that right?
A huge disruption in delivery. So that tens of thousands of the Boston Globe's couple of hundred thousand subscribers are not getting the Globe day after day after day, week after week. It was a full month of delivery disruption. And this is really the first time that the newspaper itself and the newspaper reporters acknowledged that they had no idea how the paper ever got to its subscribers.
Well, that's what's fascinating, that the Globe now, for whatever reasons, they have the idea to have the reporters and other staff deliver the Sunday paper. And this is an event. The New York Times and NPR do kind of fish out of water stories about reporters delivering the paper. My mother-in-law, Kathleen Narikas, who worked in journalism for many years, has a saying, partly humorous, that news is what happens to or near an editor. You know, and here we have a story. It's under the nose of reporters, But as you found, for the most part, and at least initially, the way they approached this story once they were kind of confronted with it and needed to report on it, the way they reported on it was kind of more of a reflection on them than on their ostensible subjects.
Yeah, and here it's not just the Boston Globe reporters, but this story was picked up nationally, so it was in the New York Times. That is, the fact that Boston Globe reporters spent one night doing what immigrant workers do 365 days a year, that suddenly made national news. So NPR, as you said, the New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, it was popping up everywhere, this amazing fact that newspaper reporters spent a night delivering the paper. And I'm surprised that no one was sort of embarrassed to acknowledge just how big this divide is and how unlikely and shocking it was that something like this could happen, that newspaper reporters could actually see how the paper gets delivered.
And what its implication is, of course, for the way that lack of experience impacts their reporting. I mean, part of what you found was reporters saying, wow, this is very eye-opening, you know, mm-hmm. the conditions that they're working in. That's dispiriting in its own way. But what you also found was a kind of, despite the confrontation with the reality and the difficulty of the job, there still was a kind of lack of interest, really, of digging into what that life was like.
Well, there were a couple of Globe reporters who really did try to get under the surface. And I have to especially give a shout out to Marcela Garcia, who's one of the few Globe reporters who actually speaks Spanish, which helped a lot, who actually interviewed some of the workers there. But most of the Boston Globe's reporting and the national level reporting ignored the workers completely. That is, it told the story about how the Boston Globe workers went out, but the emphasis was that the whole problem was software. That is, that the new company had inadequate software. So it tried to go sort of from one extreme of the reality of the grittiness and the exploitation involved in this actual physical labor and turn it into something technological and computerized and further invisibilizing the workers who actually do the work. So article after article said the problem was the software. The problem was the software.
Yeah, it's a technological fix to the difficulties. It wasn't even as if, I mean, it's an interesting thing that happened. First of all, I want to underscore, you cite one article that says, you know, whatever they're paying these people, it's not enough. Now that I've done this job, I see that it's very hard. And that idea of, well, whatever they're paying them, the fact that a reporter writing on this crisis labor situation would not have looked into it enough to see, what are they paying them? You know, what are the actual facts at hand here? What is the pay rate that these workers are objecting to?
And some of the reporting went even further. That is, they asked the Boston Globe and they asked ACI, the new carrier, and PCF, the old carrier, what they were paying. And none of those official sources were willing to tell them. But nobody asked a worker. Like, it's so easy to find out what they're paying. But they just went to the official sources and then they wrote that none of the official sources would tell them.
Well, so that's a big piece of this story, is that disconnect between the reporters, some of whom, of course, are writing about labor, some of whom are writing about immigration and immigrant communities not having this basic knowledge. But then what you wind up with about how, after some good reporting, the Globe itself seemed to come away with a kind of tech fix. What we needed was more sensible paper routes. This gets to a bigger point that you make about how we manage to disassociate, or maybe don't just manage, but work hard to disassociate our shiny, clean, virtual lives from the material world conditions and relationships that make them possible. And I take it that you see that attitude as reflected in not just media coverage, but also in policy, that we rely on these immigrant workers, but we don't acknowledge them.
And that's something that's almost built into our DNA as a country. And, you know, I teach history, so I'm always really shocked to see the extent to which students still in 2016 are coming into the classroom with these sort of sanitized, racially whitened versions of American history where inequality, exploitation, people of color, extermination of Native Americans, taking of lands are just whitewashed out.
Well, let me just pull you into that. Election season, of course, is high tide for empty rhetoric. And one of the lines that we will hear and have heard is, America is a nation of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you speak about this before. When you hear that, oh, we're a nation of immigrants, what should we be bearing in mind when we hear that evoked?
Oh, well, thank you for asking me that question, because it's a phrase that we're hearing every single day now, and it just makes my skin crawl, because when we use that kind of language, we're a nation of immigrants, we're adopting what I would call a white supremacist version of U.S. history. That is, there's a hidden word in that, which is we are a nation of white immigrants. And the reason I say that word is hidden there is that for most of U.S. history, to be an immigrant, you had to be white. That is, only white people were allowed to be immigrants, that is, people who could become citizens. People of color who either were forcibly transported to the territory or who already lived in the territory were not considered immigrants. They were not eligible to citizenship. So when we talk about Ellis Island and welcoming immigrants, we're talking about white immigrants, because only white people were allowed to immigrate during so much of U.S. history.
Well, a lack of historicity is a chronic problem with media. I mean, it's a way that coverage can work against understanding, even without being false, you know, at the level of the sentence. And continuing that historical theme, I wonder if you can talk about the historical creation of illegality. You know, because this is something that we hear all the time, that people don't oppose immigrants or immigration per se. It's the illegality of it. And I think there's a sense that that is a platonic understanding when, in fact, it's a historical creation.
And it goes back to what I was just talking about. That is, if only white people could be considered immigrants, people of color were welcomed into the country, but not as immigrants. That is, people from Africa were forced to come to the country, but not as immigrants. They weren't considered immigrants. And until really the 1960s, Mexicans were welcomed into the country also not as immigrants, but as workers, and as specifically deportable workers, because they could not be citizens, not being white. They were never considered immigrants, and there were a series of different legal regimes from the early 20th century through 1965 that over and over again reiterated the fact that Mexicans were absolutely necessary as a labor force, but they had to be deported when their labor was not needed, and that they would not be considered immigrants or potential citizens. And it's really in the civil rights climate of the 1960s that the deportability of Mexicans solely because of their racial/national categorization of Mexicans started to become problematic. And the legal systems for deporting people just for being Mexican started to be dismantled. So that in 1965, when there's an immigration quota put on Mexico for the first time, that's acknowledging Mexicans as immigrants for the first time, but turning most of the Mexicans who are still being brought here as workers into illegal workers. It's a new way of enforcing deportability on Mexicans after it becomes unpolitically correct to say, well, of course they're deportable because they're Mexican. Now it becomes they're deportable because they're illegal.
Well, and that seems so crucial and so often papered over, this idea of status, in this case immigration status, as being caste, because it allows people to say we're not discriminating, you know,
mm-hmm.
because it's not about race, it's just about criminality. And I understand that you see a connection between that status as caste and the legal disabilities that come along with it. That has other analogs in American society right now that are relevant.
Absolutely. And a lot of my thinking on this was really shaped by reading Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and looking at how new legal regimes enforce the same kinds of status under new language on African Americans.
Right. So you have African Americans disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system who, once you have a criminal record, you can't vote, you can't serve on a jury. There are other things, benefits of citizenship that don't accrue to you, but it becomes difficult or more difficult somehow or ostensibly to trace it to race because it's not about race. It's about criminal status.
Although they're the very same rights that African Americans were deprived of on the basis of race until the 1960s.
Right. Well, again, it brings us back to the way that we talk about these things and what and who is missing from that conversation. So to just kind of bring it back around to the Boston Globe story, what we had there was a moment to include immigrant workers in the conversation about their own lives. Would you say it was a missed opportunity? I mean, what do you ultimately take away from that story that you wrote about?
Well, in terms of the news coverage, I would say there were a couple of Boston Globe reporters who tried really valiantly to highlight the labor issue, to make that be the focus of the discussion. Mm-hmm. But I would say the newspaper as a whole, the management of the newspaper, and the national level coverage just absolutely refused to acknowledge that.
And with that, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is making invisible, you know, we're not talking about issues, we're talking about human beings. And a lot relies on not seeing the lives and the experiences of these people whose labor, in fact, impacts virtually every aspect of our lives. So it actually is kind of an effort to make us not see them. In a way.
And I would really say that this is just one tiny example of how our immigration system, our foreign policy, our global economic system allows privileged people in the first world to enjoy the benefits of exploited third world labor without ever having to see it. And that the privilege of getting to enjoy the material fruits of it is compounded by the privilege of not having to know it's happening.
And I can't help but add that helping us know things are happening that maybe we don't want to know about really should be part of journalists' core work, I would hope.
Mm-hmm.
We've been speaking with Aviva Chomsky. Her most recent book is Undocumented: How Immigration Became Illegal. Aviva Chomsky, thank you so much for speaking with us this week on Counterspin.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a newsletter called Extra. For subscription information, you can go to fair.org. The website's also the place to hear previous episodes of Counterspin, or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio Eco Shock, we'll see how hard it is and how possible it is to get out of the matrix. Resilience expert Dr. Nate Hagens talks about his college course, Reality 101.
So we are kind of walking fossil fuels, and I think there's no plan for what to do after our fossil fuels kind of deplete and go away. And they're not, you know, we're not going to run out of oil and gas and coal, but the cost of extracting it is going to get so high, and it's currently subsidized by financial shenanigans, that we're not going to be able to afford a lot of what is projected as a physical resource in the ground. Sure, there's a lot of hydrocarbon molecules there, but can we afford them? And then, you know, the other thing, Alex, it's not as if we have a choice to live this way for 500 or 1,000 more years, and that's what we're sacrificing. This stuff's going away in the next generation or two, no matter what we do.
Then we visit with two top American scientists whose recent study was published by the government-funded National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
We don't have a lot of time, and our study is interesting in that it says up to 80% reduction of carbon dioxide by 2030 without an increase in electric costs.
A detailed study of sun and wind says, yes, we can replace fossil and nuclear power with renewable energy, and it won't cost any more than what we're doing right now. Thank you for joining us this week as we explore where we really are and what we could do about it. I don't know about you, but I'm often stuck on Bob Dylan's words, something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Wouldn't it be great if we could take a course to understand reality as it really is? The course exists. Dr. Nathan J. Hagens teaches Reality 101, a survey of the human predicament, to students at the University of Minnesota. Nate Hagens is a familiar name to anyone who tracks energy and resilience. Nate was a successful Wall Street trader. He left all that in 2003 to probe deeper. Nate is on the board of directors of the Post Carbon Institute and a director of the Bottleneck Foundation, and he teaches. He's working on a book that he doesn't want to talk about yet. Hagens lives on a farm in Wisconsin with a collection of animals. Nate, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, we have guests that see everything in terms of energy, and others focus just on the environment. I've also had eco-psychologists. You're one of the few who are trying to wrap these all up together. Why is that?
Well, I think unless you know the whole picture or a large part of the whole picture, you end up coming to erroneous strategies and conclusions. And so some of the things you mentioned are actually the three core pillars that I taught my students and that I think are important to know. One is that we are causing the sixth great extinction. It's not just climate change and ocean acidification. I mean, those impacts are even on the horizon. It's squeezing out of nature, which we can get into more details. The second is that energy underpins everything in our civilization, and our hopes and expectations are based on fossil slaves, which are no longer going to be available in the number and strength that they have over the last century. And that means an end to the growth trajectory. And then the third thing is when we talk about the human problem of climate change and energy depletion and pollution and poverty and all these things, we really don't have those problems. We really have a human problem. So we have to look at the fact that we carry with us baggage from our evolutionary past and what the human animal is really about. So I teach my students probably half the semester is on human behavior.
Well, we'll get to those big picture demands that you make of your students, but I was struck by a course requirement to spend at least an hour a week outside, away from phones, computers, connectivity. Why is nature part of an academic study?
Well, these are mostly freshmen and some sophomores in my class, and they're honor students, and they read a whole lot. Just in my class, they read about 10 hours a week of readings, and it seems to me that kids nowadays are brought up with kind of low attention span gadgets, and when I was that age or younger, I every day after school, I spent 2 or 3 hours in the foothills in southern Oregon with my dog looking at salamanders and trees and blackberries and deer and such. And I think kids nowadays, a lot of them haven't had that experience. So when we're talking about the bottlenecks of the 21st century and the human clash with everything that's coming, I think we have to engage both the head and the heart. So I assigned them 1 hour of being in nature with no technology and no talking, just kind of sitting and thinking about the things we learn in class, sitting in a wild setting, and I think that's important.
And you offer them another tool that helps them deal with the uncomfortable aspects of what we're about to talk about, and I thought, well, maybe that'll help our listeners too. What is that?
Well, the first day of class, I handed out a nice little journal, a diary, to all the students, and I told them not to share that with me. It was for their own kind of emotional reactions to the things that we learned in class. They should have another notebook for the class notes and studying for quizzes and things, but this was just for their own thoughts when they learn about how important fossil fuels have been to our population increase and our consumption levels, when they learn about what's happening to the oceans and, 40% of terrestrial vertebrates are gone since they were born type of things. Those are very depressing and emotive facts, and I wanted to just give them somewhat of an outlet to express themselves and maybe come back later in their lives and look at what they were thinking when they were 19.
Well, right. Nate Higgins, you are well known as an energy commentator. What does the current glut of oil and these low prices tell us about peak oil theory and energy limits?
Well, you used an important term there, Alex. You said energy prices. I think most people are unaware that there's a difference between price and cost. And the price today, oil was down 5% in the public market, closed under $30 a barrel. That's what consumers pay. But that's not the cost of oil. The cost of oil has gone up over 15% a year annualized the last 15 years or so. The cost to energy companies in extracting that. Now, we're having a little bit of a bout of deflation globally because of China kind of hitting the brakes on some things, and that means that the cost of oil is maybe dropping a little bit. But if you look at what price the oil companies need to break even globally, it's probably over $50 all in. And on the really expensive marginal barrel, it's upwards of $80 or $90. So when we talk about $30 is what consumers are paying, yet the oil companies are all losing money at that level, what that means is there's going to be a lot less investment in infrastructure and new drilling and things like that to replace the depleting older fields. So I think that oil is probably peaking very soon. In response to your question about peak oil, though, I don't like that term because it just focuses on when there's going to be a peak and a decline, and it doesn't tell the larger story that at really expensive oil, say oil was $400 a barrel, well, the oil companies are going to go out there and find more oil at $400 a barrel. But the benefits to society are going to be substantially less the higher oil prices go. So I prefer to call it peak benefits as opposed to peak oil, and I would argue that peak benefits is about a decade ago. In other words, the benefits that society gets from super cheap oil have already peaked and are declining, and you see it all over with lower wages, and half of Americans have less than 3 months of savings, wealth inequality. You see it in Europe with the refugee crisis, and all those things are tethered to higher costing fossil fuels.
You know, the course that you're offering has some really challenging texts on, and videos on systems theory and complexity, and it strikes me only a few people are really going to get this. And is there some sort of social machinery or way to make this knowledge useful to make it work? I mean, do you believe in trickle-down consciousness?
Trickle-down consciousness, what is that?
Well, if you let's say your students get it, just a few of your students really get it, get a picture of how this world is working, will they be able to make any difference, or are there other great big pieces of machinery that just keep us going in the same direction anyway?
Well, that's numerous questions, Alex. I will tell you this first off, that you saw my syllabus. It is a lot of stuff. It's integrating anthropology, evolutionary psychology, energy, economics, debt, environment, all into one cohesive picture. There wasn't a section that my kids didn't understand. They grasped it all. Now, what was still an open question is a 19-year-old or is anyone emotionally capable of synthesizing all this and coming up with a life plan? I think the bigger question isn't can you understand the complexity? It's how do you construct a lifestyle around knowing what's happening and being at college in order to get a job, to be a consumer, and all that. But I personally think it's kind of depressing to synthesize all this, but someone's got to know it. Because if no one engages with the larger challenge of what are humans going to do this century, what do we aspire to, you know, then we're going to kind of be the lemmings that just go off the cliff in various ways. So I do think it's not entirely threatening. Some of it is exciting, but I do want more people to think in systems, and I wish that it could happen in sixth grade and eighth grade with some of this ecology and things. I mean, my kids were just totally shocked at how vital energy is to our lives. The fact that one barrel of oil has 11 years of human labor in it, and we pay now $30 for it. It's just crazy that they're 19 years old and they never had any idea about that. So those sort of things, I think we would be better to instill much earlier.
And you've got a course section on geologic time and paleoclimatology. Dr. Peter Ward, who's been a several-time guest on Radio EcoShock, is featured twice in your syllabus. Why Peter Ward?
Well, he's been on your show?
Oh, yeah, twice. Maybe three times.
He's one of my heroes. I mean, I just had a little email exchange with him a couple months ago. I've read most of his books. He's a systems thinker. He's what I like to label a proto-sapiens, or someone that can look beyond all the distractions and focus on kind of the core issues. And I just generally like his demeanor and what he studied. The reason that I assign his stuff to my students is he's one of the few people that has studied and looked at the commonality of prior mass and mini extinctions, and CO2 was a common link in almost all of them, if not all of them. There's now evidence that the meteor that hit 65 million years ago, there was already a CO2 pulse that had started a couple hundred thousand years before that. So just to kind of look at the context of deep time, when we talk about billions of years or hundreds of millions of years, it's like talking about billions or trillions of dollars. Our brains just can't grasp that. So one of the tools I like to use with young people is I bring either a stromatolite, which is a 2-billion-year-old cyanobacteria, or I like to have like a 100-million-year-old piece of amber with an insect in it that was frozen in amber. And when you're looking at that insect in amber, when that insect was alive, dinosaurs were still a conditional probability in the future. They didn't even exist yet. And when you're looking at that and holding it in your hand, it allows you to experience in your mind deep time actually happened, and I'm holding part of it now. And when you think about deep time backwards, you can also possibly think about deep time forward, and all the lives of different creatures, including humans, have not yet been on the planet, and it's kind of a profound thing to think about.
Well, we are a short blip on that time scale, but we have evolved even in our own time. I watched a Reality 101 course video about evolutionary psychology. It's a YouTube interview with John Tooby and Lita Cosmides on Stone Age minds. Do you find yourself agreeing that the human mind doesn't arrive as a blank slate but may have structures designed to cope with the problems of a hunter-gatherer society right inside us?
Well, of course I agree with that because I assigned my students that. It's I don't know about Canada, but I've given lectures in Europe, and it's like obvious to students there. But in America, it, especially with the high standard deviation of high school education, it was a real eye-opener to students to think that we, all of us alive today, are descended from the best of the best, an unbroken series of ancestors who had access to resources, were successful in mating, were successful in raising offspring, and all those adaptations that led to their success were kind of hardwired in our ancestors, and we have those things. So we know with certainty that we spent a very, very, very long time in small bands of between 50 and 150 tribal members on the plains of Africa, and we are descended from them. You can imagine what are the things that led to their success. And those are the things today that shout loudest in our brain. Things like jealousy and in-group preference and fear, you know, all the things that led to their success are still with us today. And we just are reacting in a different world. When we have a craving at night for Haagen-Dazs ice cream or nachos with cheese sauce, it's our brain reacting to these supernormal stimuli of today that weren't available in our ancestral past, but the neurotransmitters and the brain signals are telling us this is good for you, you need more of this, because our ancestors had adaptive advantages. So once you start looking at human behavior with the lens of we are carrying around a Stone Age mind, and it's not all facts and what culture dictates that drives us, that we have these genetic leashes. It really kind of is a powerful lens into looking at what's possible and what's unlikely in our behaviors.
Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Nate Hagans about Reality 101. Nate, you've also written an article, The Psychological Roots of Resource Overconsumption. I couldn't find that anywhere online. What is it about?
Well, it's kind of what I was just saying. It's that we are forming years as a species. We're in an environment of scarcity and privation. And now we're in an era of plenty because of fossil largesse, giving us all kinds of gadgets and ability to fly to the moon or fly to Australia and ship things to us. And so if we look at our evolved drivers, there is no natural negative feedback living in a tribal setting in Africa to more stuff. We just kind of had what we could get and carried around with us. Now there is no instinctive limit to our craving for more and more stuff. And I used to manage money for billionaires on Wall Street, and I could see that it was just the feelings that they were after every day, trying to get from $300 million to $400 million in their bank account. It didn't really count for anything. They weren't happier. They didn't, you know, need that extra money, but they were getting the same neurotransmitters that our ancestors got on the Pleistocene when they killed a big animal and brought it back to the tribe. And I think there's also the addiction aspect to it. And we get higher and higher hedonic ratchets, higher and higher levels of baseline stimulation from modern things. You know, I actually am worried about young people today that spend so much time on Facebook and Vines and Twitter and Instagram. And every time we do that, we get a little bit more neurally hijacked because this is like cocaine to our brain relative to the experiences our brain was formed for. And what happens is, you know, planting a tomato or doing a nature hike on Vancouver Island doesn't shout as loudly to people as this new technology. And I fear that as today's youth gets older, they're not going to have the attention span to deal with some of the very physical problems coming down the road.
Well, speaking of physical problems, I want to skip over to another topic here. Do you think there's a hidden crisis in agriculture?
Well, the hidden crisis in agriculture is that, you know, a third of our arable land has gone away in the last few decades via pollution and washing into the ocean. And we don't seem too concerned about that because we just put new fertilizer on it the next year, which comes from fossil fuels. You know, 150 years ago, our bodies were entirely formed from sunlight and soil, and now 50% of the protein and 80% of the nitrogen in our bodies comes pretty much directly from natural gas via the Haber-Bosch fertilizer process. So we are kind of walking fossil fuels, and I think there's no plan for what to do after our fossil fuels kind of deplete and go away. And they're not, you know, we're not going to run out of oil and gas and coal, but the cost of extracting it is going to get so high, and it's currently subsidized by, you know, financial shenanigans, that we're not going to be able to afford a lot of what is projected as a physical resource in the ground. Sure, there's a lot of hydrocarbon molecules there, but can we afford them? And then, you know, the other thing, Alex, I don't know if this is on one of your later questions, but it's not as if we have a choice to live this way for 500 or 1,000 more years, and that's what we're sacrificing. This stuff's going away in the next generation or two, no matter what we do. And so we're just so focused on the present. Quarterly earnings is, you know, that's what everyone's talking about, but we don't even have a 5-year plan, let alone a 20-year plan or a 50-year plan or a 1,000-year plan. And that, again, is because of our evolutionary psychology. Our ancestors that focused on the distant future would have been outcompeted by people or organisms that consumed any food they found. So to defer reward is something that's kind of against our nature.
I disagree in one sense, though, because we did adapt to living in northern climates by figuring out how to store some food. So there is that idea of storing, as the Egyptians did. They stored grain for several years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That just modulates the expected standard deviation of feast or famine. So, yeah, we can focus on the next season out, but were the Egyptians focused on 50 years out? I mean, we never really had to before. There was always, you know, some new horizon or a new continent to go to, but now we're living on an ecologically full planet, so the rules might be a little bit different.
Well, if things don't go well, and there are plenty who are pessimists now, in your course Reality 101, there is a segment on mass extinction. Where do you stand on the idea of human extinction, whether it's in this century, as suggested by Dr. Guy McPherson, or in the next coming centuries?
Well, you brought up Guy McPherson. I actually showed my students on the climate change part of the class a video, one of his videos. And I showed it back-to-back with a video from a former Greenpeace guy named Patrick Moore, who's denies that climate change is a concern and actually thinks that burning fossil fuels has staved us off from the death of plant life. And both of these guys are articulate and intelligent and trained and believable, but they come across with wildly different conclusions. And I think that exercise was intended to show them that there's a vast disparity of opinions on climate change, but it really hammered home some of what I tried to teach them about cognitive biases and the fact that we are definitely not rational creatures. And so I, you know, as far as extinction goes, I view the world as a probability distribution, and I think some bad things are definitely possible. Actually, some bad things are pretty likely. I think extinction is extremely unlikely, and I will definitely not say zero, but we're awfully adaptive creatures. The problem I have with Mr. McPherson is to say, oh, we're going extinct, there's nothing we can do, there's all these climate feedbacks. To have that position is functionally equivalent to being a denier of these problems, because neither camp will accomplish anything. It hasn't F-word happened yet, so Guy and his acolytes are being useless, in my opinion. And if they really think that these things threaten the world, they should be out there doing some inconvenient things trying to stop it. So I think the nihilistic, we're going to go extinct, is not a productive thing, even if it were true. I think we're going to go through various bottlenecks this century, and I would bet that we're going to have more people alive as opposed to less in the next 20 or 30 years. Not saying that's a good thing. I just think that's probably likely. But this all comes down to, what do we aspire to? And I think that's a question that's just not being asked enough. I mean, we're all concerned about climate change, so let's build solar panels. And, you know, we're concerned about financial depletion, so our financial currency crises, let's buy some gold. I mean, we just don't have a plan on what humans, now that we know where we came from, who we are, what we need, what we're doing to the planet, what's the plan? What do we really want to do with our time here? And I'm hoping that young people can address that question and start thinking about it, because I think the older people are kind of cognitively checked out, because it seems too daunting.
You know, we're not going to have time to really get into what the climate ocean bottleneck is, but you said it really affected your students. Could you at least give us a snapshot of what you're talking about there?
Well, we had a week on climate change and a week on ocean acidification, and we showed some videos and stories about what the ocean continuing to take up the excess CO2 might imply for the future. And I don't think we know enough about any of this stuff to know with certainty what's going to happen. But, you know, I'm in Minnesota, and we're not near the ocean here. And I think a lot of people just think the ocean is where we get shrimp and mahi-mahi from, and they don't really think about the complexity and the creatures there. So to think of how much the ocean has already been decimated, you know, 90% plus of pelagic fish is gone, 98% of whale biomass gone. And to put an emotional face on those things, my writing partner has experience with cetaceans, and not only in researching them, but also having them as friends. And so hearing his personal stories about relationships with dolphins, et cetera, hit the kids pretty hard. Because we don't know if the food webs will exist, I'm not talking about this century, but in the next 1,000 years, if the ocean acidifies greatly, that has pretty ominous implications for some of those other mammals in the ocean.
Yes, I just interviewed a scientist who did a study on plankton and found it's possible that the source of our oxygen could be greatly depleted if the ocean warms too much, but that's a whole other topic. I do want to get to this point here. On resilience.org, I found another text required in the course. It's called A Prosperous Way Down. It's by Howard and Elizabeth Odom. Is there a prosperous way down, and why should we accept going down at all?
I don't think we're ever going to vote to keep carbon in the ground. I think our fossil slaves are going to be leaving us before we leave them. And that's going to mean one thing almost for sure: there's going to be a lot more poverty, and it's going to be deeper poverty. I think that Americans, and I think Canadians are pretty similar, we consume around 230,000 calories a day, and our bodies only need 3,500 or 3,000. So all that excess energy that we consume from coal, oil, and natural gas is around 70 times what our bodies need. So as far as a prosperous way down, there's a heck of a lot of buffer. We're living at one of the richest times, with the exception of the natural world, the richest times in the history of our species. So there's a lot of potential navigable ways down. But, you know, the agenda of the gene, as it were, the things that shout loudly to us when we feel like we've been unfairly treated and other people are getting more than we are, or other nations, you know, war and violence and those sort of things are likely companions on that. But I think it all comes down to what you were saying before about some trickle-down consciousness of who we are, what we want, and what makes us happy. And I flip back and forth between naive optimism and despair on how this all plays out. But I think to have young people engaged with reality of energy, environment, and behavior, you know, there could be some emergent properties that are actually pretty exciting. And we can't visualize it now. It's so natural for us to kind of hear some bad news in the internet or in our emails and extrapolate that forward. But I think there's quite a few possible positive game moves that are left.
Okay, so what does the individual do about this?
Well, I think you know that I'm writing a book kind of on that. I think you have to kind of take your awareness of likely futures, which we're going to have basically less stuff or at most the same amount as today. And I think we have to look at choosing our own paths during that time, where we pick our friends and we pick our pastimes and we choose what we value. And I'm going to hopefully have a longer list of that to share with you the next time we talk. But it has to do with kind of dismissing the consensus trance of what other people value and what they think is the goal and march to your own drummer a little bit. I don't think we're going to stop the heat engine, as it were, of burning fossil fuels, but I think we can meet it halfway, and that comes from individuals and then groups of individuals and then towns and nations, et cetera.
When do you think your new book will be ready?
Excellent question. You know, it's hard to kind of tell the whole story in a way that can be understood and grasped, but also in a inspiring and hopeful way, because I am hopeful that we're going to make some good decisions that we can't yet see. I would hope by the beginning of next semester, which would be September, it'll all be ready, and I will definitely send you a copy.
Great. Well, thank you for talking with us today, and by all means, let's talk about this book when it comes out later this year.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. It's not easy trying to become aware in a troubled world. Nate Higgins takes his students at the University of Minnesota through a wide but shallow collection of tools in his course called Reality 101, A Survey of the Human Predicament. Nate has a master's degree in finance from the University of Chicago and a PhD in natural resources from the University of Vermont. He left Wall Street money to become an alternative social critic. His personal website is called The Monkey Trap, but he doesn't update that much. I'll put some link to Nate Higgins' articles and a few key YouTubes from the course in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Wouldn't it be great if most of the electricity generated in America came from wind and solar instead of climate-wrecking fossil fuels? Of course it can't be done, except it can. Who says so? Hippies from California? Not quite. It's all in a new paper by a former senior scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and a physicist math whiz from CSERES, the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Let's see if we can map the energy future with Dr. Alexander MacDonald, known as Sandy, the recently retired director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, and Dr. Christopher Clack from CSERES, and they're all in Boulder, Colorado. Sandy and Chris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Hello, thank you.
Let's start with you, Sandy. What the heck? How did NOAA come to post a study on how to power America with alternative energy?
It really started 6 years ago when I was really looking at why people say wind and solar won't work. You know, they said, well, they're too intermittent and they're too expensive. And I thought, gee, that isn't true. That's intermittent if you have a little area like the size of one state or something like that. But what it is really evident to somebody who studied weather for a few decades is the scale of weather is big. So if you want to have a big enough area so that if it's not blowing in one place, it'll be blowing another, you can't go with something small like the state of Kansas. It must be much bigger. So we set out to study that and in the process really looked at all the aspects of how wind and solar energy could go into the electric system.
Chris Clack, how did you get involved in figuring out this potential for solar and wind power?
So I came into the project to look at how I could build a model to try and incorporate these different technologies using really high detailed weather data. And it was quite a difficult computational task to get the model to be able to bring in all these millions of bytes of data, to do the number crunching, to also include all the salient features of the electric grid as well. And so I came in as a mathematician to try and build that model to try and make it as accurate as we could.
And as you said, Sandy, the big question with wind and sun has always been their intermittent nature. The sun goes down behind the clouds and the wind can stop blowing. Sandy, can we get past that really?
We really can. And Chris's model was pretty marvelous. It basically showed that if you tell the model you have to minimize annual costs, but you can put wind and solar anywhere you want. In our case, we were studying the United States, so we were looking at the 48 contiguous states. And you can use other things like transmission or storage or whatever. But the model itself was built around take these components of the electric system and find the least expensive configuration of a national system. And so Chris developed the model, and we did probably a couple hundred runs of different kinds. And so we're talking in our paper about one that was really important, which was using wind and solar and natural gas whenever, in fairly rare cases, when you don't have enough wind and solar. And we looked at the size that you need. So we divided the U.S. into really small areas the way the AC power system drives us to, that is the alternating current, which really has to be used in fairly small areas. And what the paper talks about is the simulator basically says you can get low cost and low carbon energy by using the largest possible domain. So we thought it was a very important result from this new simulator that Chris had developed.
And the other monumental challenge is the need for storage, or do we need storage at all?
The interesting thing is storage is one of the things we included in this optimization. So it's always going to look at things like offshore wind and storage and long line transmission, long line being like these big high voltage DC transmission. And it's going to decide which is the least cost. In the case of storage, at the estimated cost for 2030, which was the year that we took as our target, it did not use the storage. And it also used very little offshore wind. So this is basically an economic study that says build the lowest cost system in the simulator to tell us what the policy options are for the future. Chris, you might want to add to that.
I agree. Essentially, what happened was when we put everything into the model with the cost estimates that we had, storage just didn't play a major role. The transmission itself allowed us to use space and time as the storage medium. So as storms move through, the power can be distributed across the U.S. the majority of the time. And then the natural gas can then be used as peaking plants or backup plants to fill in the gaps, which ended up being cheaper than having storage put in.
But, you know, I've seen studies that say about half of the electricity produced in the United States today is lost in transmission. Chris, if the wind is blowing in the west and we need that electricity in New York City, how does it get there?
So in the model, one of the major components with the national system that the simulator sort of developed is that there's this HVDC overlay on top of the existing transmission. So it's high voltage direct current instead of the alternating current. And what that allows us to do is it actually has lower losses than the traditional AC, and it allows power to be shipped much further. And so with that, we can move power from, say, the desert southwest to New York with roughly 12% losses. But that's actually far less than you would have with AC, and the power would get there at the frequency you need it for that particular market. And so what it allows us to do is be more efficient with the system rather than just shipping it along AC. If you do it with AC, there's lots of technical difficulties that you have to do to try and move it longer distances, which adds up to more and more losses.
Has this DC transmission line been done anywhere in the world? Is it a real technology?
My comment is it's a well-known technology. People have been using it for many, many years. There's a high-voltage DC line that goes from Oregon to Southern California, and the Chinese have just built two big, long, very powerful lines of HVDC. Alberta just created a 300-mile line. So a key component of our study was to say we were only going to look at technologies that exist today, that we know what their costs are, at least can get good estimates for the next 15 years by 2030, and nothing that was sort of like, well, we need a breakthrough or something. We weren't going to allow those, because the key thing is, I think the problem of mitigating carbon dioxide really can't wait. As director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, until a month ago, a lot of our studies were how urgent it is to do something about CO2, and this was kind of looking at the other end of it, saying, well, can we use the weather data to tell us something that would really work with existing technology? So it was really a kind of the other half of the problem that was very exciting to work on.
So how do we know where solar power will turn on, and how can you calculate what to expect during a year?
Well, I'll mention the weather data. We have what's called a weather assimilation model. So that's something that takes all the existing measurements at a given time, like within a given hour, like all the aircraft wind measurements and, you know, surface weather stations and satellites. It uses all that data to actually tell us what the detailed weather. We had 150,000 little rectangles over the United States and southern Canada. We'd get a value of what the winds at 80 meters would be and so on. So this extraordinarily detailed weather data every hour for 3 years at 150,000 points, we used that at the same time we had the U.S. usage of electric load, people actually turning on their toasters or whatever, at 250 areas over the United States. So we matched them in time, and we told our system, minimize the total cost for the year, but you have to meet the demand for electricity over all these different locations in the United States. And that was sort of the problem we gave Chris, and he used something called linear programming to solve it.
And Chris, when you mapped out the potential for alternative energy, does wind produce more power than solar?
So when we did the cost optimization, the results show that with the optimal solution, we actually get about 38% of the electricity from wind and 17% from solar. So it's kind of a 2-to-1 ratio. There is actually a higher potential over the whole U.S. for solar, but the problem is that solar goes to bed at night, so the sun goes down and you can't produce anything. And so actually with wind and solar together, what happens is the solar actually peaks in the middle of the day. It starts dying away, but the wind actually starts picking up as the sun goes down, and as it transitions to the evening, the wind will actually pick up. And so two together actually complement each other very nicely. But overall, because you have day and night with wind, it ends up having more energy, more electricity produced from wind than from solar.
And so how many solar panels and wind turbines would we need to power at least most of the electricity needs of America?
So the wind turbines, it's approximately 205,000 2.5-megawatt wind turbines placed across the U.S. And then with the solar panels, we've worked out it was roughly 360 gigawatts of solar. And so I think that works out to be roughly 1 million solar panels.
So that's acres of solar panels and a lot of wind turbines. Sandy, what do you think about the inevitable battles over where to put these things?
Well, one of the things that we did is we didn't put high density. We sort of said you could put one of these every square kilometer, and we also used land use to determine all the places that they couldn't go. You couldn't put them in national parks, cities, areas that were steep slopes, all kinds of things. So we really kind of have a system where the optimizer will choose areas where they could really go, like out in the country. And if you drive around these wind farms, you'll see the farmers with their cornfields or their wheat fields, and the turbine itself is out in the middle. It's kind of a cash flow for the farmer. It's not really encumbering a lot of space. And in fact, I think Chris has some calculations that doesn't encumber a huge area.
The combination of the wind and the solar would be developed in a combined area smaller than Rhode Island would be changed from its existing use.
And did I hear you say, gentlemen, that we can't go for 100% solar and wind? We might still need some fossil fuel backup.
Yeah, yes, the way the system works is we have natural gas power plants as what we call a dispatchable. So that means that almost all the time the wind and solar somewhere in the United States are there, but not all the time. And again, this is a cost minimization. So we're actually using whatever price the natural gas is. So essentially, if there's not enough, it will use natural gas. Now, why doesn't it use very much? It doesn't use very much because if it uses it in the optimizer, it has to pay the fuel cost, the actual natural gas that gets burned, whereas it can always, in essence, other than the capital cost, get the wind and solar for free. So it's kind of a nice way to look at it that it will only use the fossil fuels. And another point about this is you can do something with this optimizer, like say, well, there is no natural gas available, and you have to use only wind and solar. If you did that, you might find the price is much higher because it has to essentially build out in this simulation enough wind and solar so that it always produces. And that's very similar to many economic goods. You get 80% reduction, up to 80% reduction of carbon dioxide with no increase in cost. But if you say, boy, it has to be 100%, then you're probably going to something like double your costs of electricity. And we basically had the hypothesis that wind and solar can be effective, but not if they increase electric costs a whole lot.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Alexander Sandy McDonald, recently retired from NOAA, and Chris Clack from Ceres in Boulder, Colorado. They have mapped out how America could get most of its electric needs from solar and wind power. Well, Sandy, I know that you've been studying this. Weather patterns may change as the world warms. What about developments during climate change? Did you include that in your model?
No, we didn't. And one of the neat things about the news model that was developed by Chris is if we want to put in different weather data or different cost data, it's a model. So it's really just a tool for policymakers to say, well, what if this happens? I will say this, that I did take the time a couple years ago to look at some of our global climate models for later in the century, 2030 and 2050. And what it looks like is as the century wears on over the United States, you get a little more sun and a little less wind. But they kind of canceled each other in this very simple look that we had. But we have not done that in the model.
So what happens, though, if we can't do this? Maybe the political climate is wrong or the economy goes bad. We don't get this smart grid built. Could you see a different study that explores what happens if a few million homes all power up individually with solar, or maybe local communities mount their own wind electricity companies?
I think, you know, there's many, many options. But what I would say is we don't have a lot of time. And our study is interesting in that it says up to 80% reduction of carbon dioxide by 2030 without an increase in electric costs. So that means that if we could get everybody to conserve or everybody to put panels on their roof, we may get further, but I'd be worried that we'd get nowhere near what we need to really deal with the climate change problem.
Well, I guess just as your study showed, you know, that looking at one state isn't enough, we need to look at a great big area to make this work. Maybe it's the same with the power system. We really need a national power system.
Again, another example that I like to bring up is the interstate highway system. We didn't replace the state, federal, and local roads when we put in the interstate, but we enabled a national market. And essentially what this simulator came up with, it kind of created a national electric market for the same reason, that if you can move the electrons around much more effectively, you get lower costs. And in this case, lower carbon dioxide, which are important. So it's a little bit like President Eisenhower saying in the 1950s, this would be a very valuable economic boon to the country that will last for decades and decades. And we've certainly seen that with the interstate highways.
And, you know, regarding this intermittent nature of the sun and wind power, in order to save the climate, we might have to change our lifestyles and or even our approach to industry. Maybe we could use power just when it's available from clean sources so we don't turn on our appliances, or maybe we don't go to work in the car plant if there isn't much electricity available today. What do you think about that?
I think it's really an important thing to try to conserve. That is really important. However, I also believe that people are probably going to be using more and more electricity. One of the things that's happening is that the autos, the Nissan Leaf and the Tesla and so on, are showing how effective electric autos can be in terms of less fuel cost and so on. And so even though we should do everything we can to conserve, if the amount of electricity that people use goes up and up because of these other uses, what's our answer? Are we going to build more coal plants or whatever? So I think we have some very big questions, and we should do everything we can, like conservation, but we also need big solutions to what is really a very big problem.
So, Chris, where do you think this paper could go, and the model that you've made? Could it be used by government or business? Have you had some interest yet?
I think the model itself is going to be very useful as a tool to look at different options that are available. Like Sandy's been saying, we tested this hypothesis, and we've looked at what wind and solar can do if you look at the large scale. But it can be used in different ways to look at how you could see different policy implications. So, for example, if nuclear power was decided to stop running, what would happen? What would you use to fill that gap? What's the cost-optimal solution to fill that gap? And so I think it's a very useful tool, and hopefully it'll be used in the future to make more quantitative decisions on how to progress forward with a low-carbon economy.
Since Chris mentioned nuclear power, I want to mention another aspect. People hadn't really thought about it, but there was almost a requirement because of the AC, the way AC power works, is people would place nuclear power plants not very far from heavily populated areas. And so that was another effect of AC power. So a policymaker could say, well, suppose that we get a new generation of nuclear plants. If you had this high-voltage DC interstate for electrons, you could actually place nuclear power plants very far from the population areas and really increase your margin of safety. So the real emergency that I think we've featured in NOAA for several decades is carbon dioxide going into the air is got huge implications, and nuclear is a carbon-free power also.
It must have been strange, Sandy, going to work every day and seeing the weather maps starting to shift over the years because of climate change.
I guess I'm one who believes weather is exciting and interesting and different every day from the time I was a little kid. And I think that weather is just variable, but the effects of carbon dioxide, which I think are quite clear in the rise of temperature and the increase in acidity of the ocean, these are effects that we understand that I think you can't look at the remainder of this century without saying, okay, we've got a big problem. What is the kind of solution that would really work?
Is there anything that either of you would like to add?
I'll make a quick comment that I mentioned the idea that electric usage will probably go up over the next 15 or 20 years as we get more electric cars, more heat pumps, which can air condition and heat a house. So we're really to solve the whole energy problem, not just the electric energy part of it. The first thing you have to do is to decarbonize the electric sector. If you decarbonize the electric sector, then autos, who some people project will be dominantly electric sometime in the 2020s, and space heating and other uses also become carbon-free. So we think this is an extraordinarily important first step for policymakers to consider this result, that there is a way to do a fairly rapid and affordable decarbonization of the electric sector.
Chris?
We've really found that wind and solar can do a lot of work in terms of decarbonizing the electric grid. And we've actually found that it can be cheaper than business as usual, so cheaper than just continuing the way we are, which I think is contrary to what a lot of people may have believed. And the only way that you can do that is if you do it more in a more smart way about how you deploy and how you put these technologies out. And so I think it's quite an interesting result. And hopefully once people look at it and see the amount of work that we put into trying to make it conservative, we might actually find that we can get more done than we actually found in the results.
Our guests are Sandy Alexander McDonald, who has been the director of NOAA's Earth System Research Lab, and Chris Clack from the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences at the University of Colorado Boulder. We've been talking about a new article titled Future Cost Competitive Electricity Systems and Their Impact on U.S. CO2 Emissions. It's published online in the journal Nature on January 25, 2016. You can find links to a NOAA article all about it, complete with cool maps, in my Radio EcoShock blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, both of you, for your help and joining us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Don't forget you can find all our past interviews with scientists, authors, and experts, and activists on our website at ecoshock.org. Those are free for download or listening anywhere in the world. This program is also available by podcast. You can find a detailed blog for every program with links to the original material, videos, and social media links at ecoshock.info. If you find this program useful, please tell your friends. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Can give when storms come. A human wave can come together. Minds arise as surely as the seas. divine forms in the minds of many. We believe in the heat. Days flow by to our times of trials. Minds in motion with the beat.
To talk shortly with Robin Philpott about the film Revenant, but from a Canadian point of view, and we're even going to explain the word Canadian probably while we're at it. And later we're going to get an update on the situation of very analogous, in my opinion, of Syria and the talks that are going on there, and the case of the underreported aspect of foreign intervention and manipulation of the process, and that'll be Zafar Bengash. By the way, Betsa Toon has got some important meetings coming up. There's going on the 26th. It must be tomorrow, I think. Anyway, if somebody send me a calendar. There's going to be poetry readings at Betsa Toon, 7 o'clock tomorrow. And there's going to be The Unpromised Land, early films about Israel, and that will be on the 27th at 7 p.m. And there's going to be a lecture on Greece, the austerity, the struggle, resistance against the imposition by European powers on Greece. And that's going to be on the 28th of this month at 7 to 9 p.m. And Indigenous Nationhood, which is going to be on the 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. So Betsa Toon is busy, busy, busy. BetsaToon.org. Go to that site, get you all the information. And they always have terrific events. It is a beloved community center. And we're joined now, I believe, by a publisher of Baraka Books, Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. I understand that there's been some press media reaction in Quebec to this blockbuster, monumental, How We Won the West American movie, The Revenant, about this heroic, white, powerful, rugged, I hope I get all the words right in there, individual who was a trapper and went out. A lot of evil things happen. And some writers in Quebec have pointed out there's something wrong with this film. What is it?
The only word you forgot was wasp.
I get stung by the wasp thing.
But yeah, there's been several criticisms. Probably the most virulent came from a man who was asked to act in the film. He was asked to play the role of Toussaint Charbonneau.
Yes.
Who, in fact, was the man who guided Lewis and Clark to the West.
Lewis and Clark?
In 1803. And he was originally, if I'm not mistaken, he was born here in Quebec. He was married, or he was, either his family was. And his wife was what's her name, the famous woman who...
Oh, yes, of course, who accompanied Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say I can't remember her name. I can never remember anybody's name if I'm asked.
Yeah, so this man, Roy Dupree, who is one of, I would say, a leading Canadian actor. He's won prizes at the TIFF, and he's awarded here in Quebec. He was asked to play that role, and Friday night, he came out with a statement to the newspapers, and it's really been going around. He says this is a racist film, and it distorts history, and it's a racist film.
It's racist. And are you saying he turned down the role?
Yeah, he turned down the role because
we're talking big bucks, people. That's a lot of money.
Yeah,
he turned it down on the principle that it was racist.
Yeah, but he turned it down not because he hadn't seen the scenario. He said they got in touch with him to play the role. He said that he doesn't take on roles unless he reads the script before. They refused to let him, so he said no. And then he went and saw the film, and he said he's really glad he didn't accept. Because it's an anti-French-Canadian film. It says it glorifies the Anglo-Protestant, the Anglo-American way, and how they took over the West, and gives the French a bad role, the French-Canadians, let's make it clear, and their Métis, the Métis as well, gives them the dirty role. And also it distorts history because the approach of French in Canada and in North America was one of alliances and intermarriage, and this was the time from the time of Champlain. This is a well known idea, and it's been reflected a lot. People have
were trappers and traders, right? They weren't they weren't coming for the land.
No, there would be small settlements. There were settlements from Montreal to the Pacific Northwest, right to Portland, Oregon, and up north as well. They would have small settlements built alike where there would be agriculture, but they were not looking for land. And that was what the native nations, and they called them nations, liked about it. And so they were not coming to take land. They were building alliances, because the difference between the French and the English in North America was the English needed land. They were taking land. The French didn't want to depopulate France, and so they built up alliances, and it was a totally different approach. And so he makes this point. Then there's been other ones who said, you know, if you were going to do a film about the West that's honest, you would have to point out that everything was going on in French. There were communities there from the 1650, 1660, there were the French had been visiting. They were trying to convert to Catholicism, but they were traveling, trading from the. I mean, I know that in Thunder Bay there were people up there from 1667 and Duluth as well.
200 years before this guy from Pennsylvania showed up.
Close to 200 years, and this is a phenomenon, and we're working on a book, and I'll talk about it when it comes out, but. We're working on a very important book, which I think will revolutionize the way we look at North American history. And it points out to what point, to what extent these communities of French-speaking, what you would call, they used to call Canadiens, or French-Canadian, and Métis and Native Nations lived together all across the West. It would be on the Mississippi Valley, watershed, on the Missouri watershed, the Saskatchewan River north, all the way into BC, they were there, and the common language up until mid 19th century.
The language of the trappers, the trapping business, the trappers and the European trapper, those of European origin, and the Native Americans was French, right?
It was totally French. French was the common language, and it was the language. For instance, the guy who, Bridger, I think he's referred to in the film, but Jim Bridger, a hero in American, the story of the...
Yes, there are statues of him in the U.S.
Yeah. He had to speak French fluently because there was no other way you could get along. And, you know, the one thing, you know, Americans and Canadians as well, read Alexis de Tocqueville and his observations about Democracy in America. His book is a must reading.
Yes.
The Tocqueville also visited this area in 1831 in what they call the Midwest now. It was called the Old Northwest, which is Michigan, what is now Wisconsin, Green Bay, all that area.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just flabbergasted, what I would say, by all the people who he met. They were all French-speaking. And in his observations, it was a book which was published only posthumously, which has not been circulated. It's called A Fortnight in the Wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to go to the wilderness. What he called the wilderness, as he realized, was teeming with what they were called Canadiens, which means French Canadians, and Métis. And he was just like, he just couldn't believe it. And he said, he had, and I'm sort of quoting it here, he said, it's comparable to the French peasantry, but morally superior, he said. They also quickly adopt the natives' way of life. And then he talked about them covering all the borders of Canada and the U.S. He said that they spoke French like the Normand, like from Normandy. He spoke that well, that way. They had the same folklore, the same way of talking. And then he met in northern Michigan a guy who called himself a Canadien, you know, a French Canadian. But he looked more native. I mean, he was copper-colored. This is de Tocqueville's thing. And he asked him, he said, is it true that the Indians love the French? And the man replied. He said, yes, sir, extremely. They do not consent to speak anything but French.
Mm-hmm.
In the furthest wilderness, the quality of being a Frenchman is the best recommendation with them. They always remember our good treatment of them when we are masters of Canada. And so this is de Tocqueville writing. Of course, these writings of de Tocqueville have never been made widely known. So
kind of like Jane Jacobs on National Question.
Yeah, and the thing is that in order to create this myth of how we won, how the West was won,
yes,
the people who they took it from, who might have said how the West was lost,
yes,
have to be erased. And so that's basically what this film does.
Well, and not only does it erase, I mean, what you describe and the actor opposed was the French are turned into actual villains. They take a native man.
Yeah.
And they hang him. No, they hang his son, the mm-hmm. French do, French trappers, which, by the way, I can't think of a dumber thing for a man in the wilderness to do than hang a local native because he ain't going to go home safe, I could tell you.
No.
But Hollywood lets him do that. And then they rape the native women, but it's the French doing that.
Yeah.
Not the wonderful Mr. Glass and his friends. No, it was the French.
Yeah,
it's an erasure, you might say, with a lot of elbow grease.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And this actor Roy Dupree, you know, he just said this clearly. He called it a racist film, and it is. You know what? It's the John Wayne tradition. It's just sort of modernized a bit, but you know, it's how we won the West. And you know, people.
And by the way, the way we won is by believing in revenge and mm-hmm. violently solving every problem.
Right, exactly. Whereas, prior to that, now, not that there hadn't been fighting going on, but here you had these communities, and they're all over. And anybody who wants to look at the maps can just get an idea of all the names that dot, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, Pierre in South Dakota.
Yeah.
Boise, all these, the refuge up in the Oregon called Malheur, you know, the town where this terrible shooting in Saskatchewan went on, La Loche, the names of all the people there are basically all French names.
Yes.
You just can't, that just gives you an idea, but really that just touches the surface because there were communities and towns in all across the North America, and so...
Yeah.
What they've done is basically pursued the myth of the United States.
Myth is more helpful to them than history. It's better to have a good myth that you use it like a blanket, right, to cover over reality.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyway, it just happened that we see this film when this film comes out, and we're working on this book by three very, very skilled writers and researchers, and it's going to be a good book on pointing out the nature of what the West was before the Anglo went and the British went west.
Yeah.
And both the Anglo-Americans and the British had to erase the French existence. It just, yeah. In other words, you couldn't. Your nation building had to remove that from the story, and they effectively did so. And this film does the same thing.
I'll ask you just to make sure I got the word right. One of our leading actors wrote a public letter, in which he said the film is racist.
He was interviewed coming out of the film. I think he organized that interview, and he said this is racist, it's anti-French Canadian.
Oh, great. Well, Robin, it's a very important story. I look forward to that book.
We'll keep you informed and get it to you as soon as it's available.
Great. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for calling.
Okay. Bye. And that's Robin Philpott, and that is an important book. The film, just let's be clear, the name is, it's called The Revenant. The character in the story, his name was Hugh Glass. It does matter, doesn't it, that the film's lying? He didn't have a son by a native woman who was with him. There was no son that was killed for whom he would have been taking revenge. He did live, he did survive, and he met the two individuals who had left him behind. I think everybody roughly knows the story. He did not harm either one of them. There's a kind of odd writing about this. He didn't kill him, they said, in fact. Well, that's right. Maybe he didn't feel like it because maybe there was no basis to kill him. It's maddening, again, that Hollywood does this and everybody says based on a true story. No, well, it's not true that he had that episode happened in the way that they describe. What happened was a party was hunting and one of the party was attacked by a grizzly bear. The bear won a decision, not a knockout, and the other two partners thought he was going to die, and they left him, but he made his way out. By the way, it's not the first time that story has been told in North America. Hollywood adds bunk that he was seeking revenge. In fact, he seems to have been a decent human being. He saw the two individuals, but he didn't ask anybody to arrest one of them. There was a government, by the way, at that time, and he was at a fort. If he thought they had done him wrong, they could have arrested them. He never did that. And to have that phrase based on a true story is just appalling. There's a wonderful review in The Guardian by a woman whose name I think her name is Callender, but I'm sorry to get it wrong, who said that it's really violence porn. She says basically it's just putting us all through awful things because she says that the commanding taste of the moment is for more and more wretched conduct on film. And she said, in a way, Hollywood seems to be trying to compete with ISIS in terms of awful things they will show you. And she really made a sharp objection to all this.
From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An apparent breakthrough in Syrian peace talks in Munich was announced in the wee hours Friday at a press conference held by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
What we have here are words on paper. What we need to see in the next few days are actions on the ground in the field.
This is a complicated task. There are too many stakeholders involved in military activities, and it is important to use the unique potential of the International Syria Support Group, which unites almost all countries that have some kind of leverage on those fighting on the ground.
CCTV's Guy Henderson was there for the early morning announcement and filed this report from Munich.
The U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, was the last of the diplomats to leave the Hilton Hotel here in Munich. He walked out of this door at just before 2 a.m. local time after several hours of talks with the International Syria Support Group. 17 countries from around the world, all of the major stakeholders. There was even representation from the Syrian opposition here as well. And there was what appears to be, and I say this cautiously, a very significant breakthrough. Just to give you the highlights of it, firstly, an immediate or almost immediate channel of humanitarian aid running into Syria. That will be overseen by a working group, which will start its work in Geneva, in Switzerland, within literally a few hours from now. And humanitarian aid we expect to start flowing into Syria, overseen by Russia and the United States, cooperating in that regard. Humanitarian aid flowing into Syria. Then number two, at the conclusion of these talks, during a press conference, Secretary of State Kerry announced that there would be a cessation of hostilities within 1 week. Again, a task force assigned, again overseen by the Russians and the Americans, that will prepare the forces on the ground, the complex web of different factions and forces battling each other through this increasingly complex civil war towards a cessation of hostilities. It's not at this stage being called a ceasefire, but a cessation of hostilities, some discussion around whether there may be a difference between those two. But certainly diplomats here seem to believe that at this stage, UN resolution 2254 can still be on track. And just to remind you, that would be a peace deal by the middle of this year and elections by the middle of next year. Well, another significant development appears to be what the Russian foreign minister said was a new level of cooperation militarily as well, actively cooperating in what he described as a common approach towards ISIL and also military forces operating over Syria, trying to coordinate to ensure that there aren't similar incidents to the one we saw between Turkey and Russia on two occasions in recent months. And major differences do remain between these both sides, both the US and Russia particularly here. There was no secret of that during this press conference between these two men. Kerry spoke about how Russian aggression in Aleppo, in the key city of Aleppo, had undoubtedly, he said, given Assad a stronger footing, but he said that was only short term and that in the end there should still be a political transition. Lavrov's response to that was that, the Syrian government, in his view, had every right to take out and remove what the Syrian government and the Russian government see as an illegitimate force occupying the city of Aleppo.
Millions poured into the streets of Tehran to celebrate the anniversary of Iran's revolution in 1979. Press TV's Hamid Javani was there and filed this report.
On the occasion of the 37th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, once again, Iranians from all walks of life took to the streets in their millions to demonstrate the support for their country. These rallies are held on the 22nd of the Iranian calendar month of Bahman.
I want to prove that no matter what the enemies do, we are behind our leader and the Islamic Republic. We will never give up.
I want to say to all the people in the world, we have came because we want the support of the innocent people that are being killed by America, Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Regarding the latest atrocities committed by supporters of extremism and terrorism, we express our solidarity with our country in the face of all the insecurity in the region.
All cities and towns inside the Islamic Republic witnessed these rallies in celebration of the victory of the revolution that put an end to the monarchical rule of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime.
Our participation in these rallies comes a few weeks after the implementation of the JCPOA that was a major victory for our nation and that they cannot be taken for granted.
Analysts say Iranians' massive turnout at rallies demonstrates the nation's readiness to confront any foreign pressure. Iran, as a superpower in the region, is known for its high security standards and is considered essential for maintaining peace and security in the region. Hamid Javani, Press TV. Tehran.
Among those in the Iranian capital for the celebration was an American, the head of the Nation of Islam, Minister Louis Farrakhan, who recited some of Iran's history and its relationship with the United States over the past 60 years.
Iran has been through a lot, living under the Shah, but before him, Brother Mohammad Mossadegh, a man who was democratically elected, was overthrown by the CIA after he nationalized the oil in this country. He wanted the revenue of oil to benefit the people of Iran. America and Britain and others wanted the benefit of that oil, so they put someone in place that would give them access to what they wanted. I would hope that at this latest stage, where you are now coming out from under sanctions that were designed by the West to destroy the revolutionary spirit of the Iranian people and cause the Iranian people to rise up against their government. But thanks to Allah, the people of Iran stood firmly with their leadership, and the sanctions only caused Iran to look deep within itself. And now those sanctions are being lifted, but Iran is stronger, Iran is wiser, Iran is more influential.
More political spectacle with Thursday's Democratic Party debate, the sixth thus far, with Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at center stage.
I voted against the war in Iraq because I listened very carefully to what President Bush and Vice President Cheney had to say, and I didn't believe them.
Two points. One, Senator Sanders voted in 1998 on what I think is fair to call a regime change resolution with respect to Iraq, calling for the end of Saddam Hussein's regime. He voted in favor of regime change with Libya. I do not believe a vote in 2002 is a plan to defeat ISIS in 2016. Calling the president weak, calling him a disappointment, calling several times that he should have a primary opponent when he ran for re-election in 2012. You know, I think that goes further than saying we have our disagreements.
One of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate.
To take a look behind the curtains at the U.S. election and the broader social landscape, we spoke with scholar and activist Professor Anthony Montero. Professor Montero's academic work is focused on Marxism and race. He's the former head and founder of the African Studies program at Temple University. We spoke with Professor Montero via telephone from Philadelphia Friday. We're supposed to be discussing public policy, and there are certainly enough needs to go around that could be on the table, and instead we have this going on. What's the deal?
Well, I think that's only part of the picture. But I think what it all leads back to is the fact that the black vote will decide who will be the Democratic Party nominee. And that's not just for South Carolina and the South. It's also for places like Pennsylvania, where the Philadelphia black vote is going to be really critical. And so this is kind of the start, the real beginning of the primary within the Democratic Party. And while I am not one who sees the Democratic Party as the vehicle for radical change and the type of change we need in this moment, this time in history, I do see the Bernie Sanders phenomenon as having meaning beyond the Democratic Party. And the reason I say that is that the struggle within the Democratic Party is really a struggle between the people generally and the oligarchs, the 1%, the plutocrats, and the neoliberal politicians. And so even a partial victory for Bernie Sanders is a victory in a long struggle going forward. Now, the other thing, the final thing is, many of the supporters of Bernie Sanders, if he does not get the nomination, will not vote for either the Democrats or the Republicans. So there's a lot going on here. The future of the Democratic Party in terms of black support for it is on the line. Even going forward a year or two ahead, we might see calls coming from within the black community and the wider progressive community for another political party to challenge both of the parties of the 1%.
Do you see any third party, quote unquote, poised to step into that?
Not yet. Not yet. We don't have anything close to it right now. But, you know, you just can't tell. I mean, you know, young people are now involved, and they have energy. They are, you know, many times the victims of the policies of the Clintons and the Obamas and the Republicans. So you just can't tell right now. I see the possibility. You know, we just had a conference here in Philadelphia that drew over 2,000 people, mainly young people, around the issue of the black radical tradition. If that was possible here in Philadelphia in January 2016, who is to say what is possible in the next few years concerning a new party of the people?
Okay, we had President Obama in 2008 elected the first black president, and not a typical African-American background. He's not here 8-10 generations or whatever. Actually, first-generation son of Africa. And from him we get AFRICOM and the destruction of Libya and the entrenchment of U.S. imperialism into the command and control of 35 African nations' military. What can we expect from a socialist who doesn't believe that workers should have control of the means of production?
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders is a socialist in a very narrow sense of the word. He is really a kind of New Deal Democrat. And I think from his perspective, and I'm only talking about him now, he wants to take the party back to its New Deal foundations. However, to call that socialism benefits the wider movement for socialism, because for the first time, and I don't know when, maybe since Eugene Debs was running for president, we have a broad discussion of socialism. Now, not only does Bernie Sanders not include in his socialism the nationalization of banks, the taking over of the means of production, and so on and so forth, what is really more problematic is the fact that his foreign policy is not that of what socialists have called for in the past. We have in the past associated genuine socialism with anti-imperialism, with anti-war, with a major and radical cuts in the military budget, and so on and so forth, a policy, as it were, of peaceful coexistence with the world. Bernie Sanders somehow doesn't see his way to that. Probably, were he not running in the Democratic Party and for the Democratic nomination, he would be freer to have a more progressive foreign policy outlook. But that having been said, Sanders can call himself a socialist, but the most important thing is that he is going after the 1% and the policies that have led to this growing economic and social inequality in the country. And finally, I don't remember a major party candidate speaking openly about institutional racism as Bernie Sanders did, as I heard him speak on it last night in the debate. So, you know, from a left and progressive standpoint, we have to calibrate the positives of the Bernie Sanders phenomenon while severely criticizing, so people don't have illusions, the limitations of Bernie Sanders and his outlook and his form of socialism.
I want to get to that, to what can be done to build on it. And just yes. In terms of further critiquing it, you mentioned Eugene Debs. Eugene Debs, of course, ran for president from prison for opposing the First World War. And his opposition to the war was based on what's at the root of the socialism that I understand, class identity in the working class with an international character, transnational character. There is one global working class. We're all members of it. That, of course, precludes imperialism. Instead, what we have with the unity of opinion, more or less, on foreign policy between Sanders, not just Clinton, but the Republicans, too, more or less, over tactics they differ, but not over strategy. You have essentially, yes, it's okay to plunder the world. When we bring it back, we want a fairer deal for the people when we divvy up the spoils. Where can that lead?
Well, you know, nothing is inevitable. So I would hesitate to say that it will inevitably lead to this or the other.
Right.
See, from my standpoint, it is not only about Bernie Sanders. It is about the millions of people who are saying, I agree with what he's saying about the way wealth and income are so divided up and unequal in this society. I think that's a huge step forward. Clearly, it's not yet socialism, but the people will decide that. It creates space. This phenomenon creates space for something that we have not seen in maybe 75 or 80 years. So that is what is positive. It comes at a time when U.S. imperialism needs a secure and safe rear base. They don't need this upheaval in the rear as they move to consolidate and expand their positions globally. But Sanders is doing this phenomena, is creating that instability, that political questioning, that questioning of the legitimacy of the political process, of the politicians, of their connection to the billionaire class, and all of that type of thing. Now, he is not, let us say, advocating class struggle. But when you examine what is happening in this phenomena, what you see is the coming to the fore of the Bernie Sanders movement, not of the middle class and intellectuals, but of the working class, of the poor. And that's why this black vote in South Carolina, in Mississippi, Alabama, and as we go forward in Pennsylvania, in California, and in Ohio, and in Michigan, is going to be so decisive, because the black vote, which usually is united on the side of the least reactionary candidates, is a working class vote. So I think that, and then of course I would add this, I mean, don't underestimate what's going on within the labor movement and the division there between the leadership and the rank and file members. Rank and file members are saying we're supporting Bernie Sanders. I think, you know, the most striking in this regard is the Chicago Teachers Union and its leadership. So a lot of things are happening at the same time. Sanders himself is not the whole picture. For example, when a person like Harry Belafonte comes out for Bernie Sanders, now a lot of people talking about John Lewis coming out for Hillary Clinton. Well, in my estimate, Harry Belafonte in historical terms is at least the equivalent of John Lewis. I think he's beyond John Lewis. Yeah. But what is Harry Belafonte supporting? He is supporting a mass uprising against the 1%.
And
so that's the way I see it, Don.
You know, back in the 30s, I mean, Franklin D. Roosevelt mm-hmm. essentially was a phenomenon in response to the growing demands Absolutely. By workers, socialists, mm-hmm. communists, and others that were mm-hmm. mass mm-hmm. movement at the time. In the same way, the social forces that are gathering outside of and underneath the political process, I mean, the political process here is essentially a way of managing the society. Mm-hmm. And what do you see? The fact that they had – that there's space for Sanders and space for a conversation about socialism, what does that reveal about what's happening in terms of the underlying movements in the country and the potential? Because you're talking about them being afraid of a rearguard action. What's the potential for developing that?
I think the potential is huge. And I think what we're looking at in the most immediate sense is a process that goes back to 2011 and the Occupy movement. And, you know, the 1% just can't shake this identification of them as the 1%. Or the 0.1%. I mean, they just can't get around that. This anti-Wall Street anger goes back to Occupy. But then it comes up through Trayvon Martin. And then Mike Brown and Eric Garner. And now this anti-police state movement. But then there are streams leading into it from the Chelsea Mannings and the Snowdens and the Assanges and those whistleblowers and those who are concerned about civil liberties and civil rights. And then, of course, this huge and growing peace movement and the environmental movement. And so I think we're seeing a convergence of forces that have not yet completely met up and said, we're all in this together. But I think the more foresighted of them recognize that there are multiple things going on. And folks are saying, let it all happen. Let it all move forward. And in some ways, Bernie Sanders is a kind of vehicle for that. Now, of course, you have the liberals who are committed to the Democratic Party. For example, the editors of The Nation magazine, they endorse Bernie Sanders. But it's pretty clear to me that they don't want a third-party movement. They want a reform of the Democratic Party. But the people who will make the Bernie Sanders movement, I think, are increasingly saying both of these parties are worthless. And both of these parties are part of a two-party duopoly, of an oligarchic regime that has no space for the democratic aspirations of the majority of people.
You think there might be people looking forward from Sanders' campaign? Well, first of all, either he wins the primaries or he doesn't, or in any event, mm-hmm. either he's the nominee or he's not. Do you think that mm-hmm. among Sanders' supporters that there are people there far-sighted enough to, for example, be lifting phone logs and voter rolls and all of the assets that the Democratic Party
makes
available?
Well, I really hope so. I hadn't thought about that. But that type of quote unquote subversive activity would be very valuable.
Because the
because, you know, you're right about that, because, you know, why would ordinary people put so much into this type of phenomenon, this type of campaign, and then if it is not successful, or even if it is successful, walk away and allow the people at the top of it, let us say, the functionaries in it, to have all of the resources that the people themselves built up? And I think, I hope there are some people who will do that.
Mm. And finally, for the rest of us who aren't engaged directly in, say, the Sanders campaign, but are watching these social developments occur, what is it we should be working on?
Well, one thing I would say that that these primaries focus upon, or force us to focus upon, local activism, building up coalitions and united fronts and carrying out all kinds of demonstrations, be they for jobs or against police murders and the criminal justice system or against gentrification. These local questions are very strategic and very central. So I think everyone needs to be a part of some community organization, some type of survival program, some form of political and socialist education of the masses of people. And that doesn't have to be a huge thing. It could be a small community organization, a tenants organization, a church organization. So I think we all should be grounded in some form of local organizing and resistance. The other thing is, I think the activists have to educate ourselves. It's not as though we have all the answers. You know, we're faced with an economy that even the people who run the economy don't understand. And because they don't understand the economy, they are fearful of the consequences of an economy that collapses or goes into chaos, and they're fearful of what the masses throughout the world will do, as they're doing in Greece and South Africa and many places that we seldom read about in the newspapers. So we have to educate ourselves. We have to understand the economy. We have to understand the society. And frankly, we have to understand the world, the people of the world. And then, of course, and the last thing I would say, a part of this political education is anti-nationalist, anti-white supremacist, anti-xenophobic, anti-Islamophobic, anti all kinds of phobias about gender and sexuality. We have to begin in this process of education to create new types of people, new types of leaders, new types of imagination of our common future.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
judicial fury. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court, in its Montgomery versus Louisiana decision, ruled that its earlier 2012 ruling in the Miller versus Alabama case, limiting life sentences when it came to juvenile defendants, was indeed retroactive and thus applied to all under the age of 18 when their crimes were committed. At least four states, Michigan, Minnesota, Florida, and Pennsylvania, determined that Miller wasn't retroactive, a decision that affected more people in Pennsylvania than any other state. That's because Pennsylvania has more juvenile lifers than any other state in the union. As a matter of fact, Pennsylvania has more juvenile lifers than any other jurisdiction on earth, more than China, more than Russia, more than Saudi Arabia, seriously. And why is this so? Are kids in Pennsylvania more vile, more devilish than kids anywhere else on the planet? I don't think so. But perhaps their political leaders are. The same might be said of state judges and justices of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, I might add, who seem to be busy sending smut to each other and to their colleagues in the state attorney general's office, too busy to care about juvenile lifers, apparently. In October 2013, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, voting 4-3, decided its Commonwealth versus Cunningham case and determined that Miller didn't apply to almost 500 men who were juvenile lifers in Pennsylvania. Men, and perhaps some women, who were juveniles when their crimes were committed. Amazingly, the majority cited to Miller's dissenting opinion the view of the Miller Court's minority to announce that, quote, determining the appropriate sentence for a teenager convicted of murder presents grave and challenging questions of morality and social policy. By citing the dissent, the Cunningham majority ignored the central holding of Miller, that children are different. Attorney Mark Bookman, director of the Philadelphia-based Atlantic Center for Capital Representation, has called the Roper, Graham, Miller, and Montgomery line of cases a juvenile revolution in law, and so it is. But the Pennsylvania courts seem to be staging a counter-revolution to reflect the political views of politicians who wrought this long war against the young, like the Clintonian former DA and later governor, Edward Rendell, and former governor Tom Ridge, and the many politicians who built more prisons than schools and fueled the dead-end phenomenon of mass incarceration. But in the 1990s, conservative scholars launched into a mad tangent against juveniles, with some notables warning about so-called super predators, black and brown kids hiked on crack, wilding on society, attacking them, eating them, it seemed. But such nightmares never materialized, for they were based on little more than racist fears and fantasies. Today, there are no super predators. That is, unless you count the politicians, judges, and scholars who preyed on the young. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. When Black History Month rolls around, many are tempted to tell great stories of great heroes and heroines, black warriors fighting for freedom against vile racists. This isn't that kind of story. When I was a reporter for public radio, I received a call from a man I knew from the Black Freedom Movement. He wanted to meet with me, but wouldn't discuss it on the phone. When I arrived at his apartment that night, his woman greeted me at the door, and he ushered me into the bedroom. He took off his shirt and turned on a weak light. When I saw his skin, I stepped back in shock, for there, from the nape of his neck to his thighs, was a riot of discoloration that I'd never seen before or since. His body looked like that of a leopard, spotted, flayed, packed with splashes of dark and light skin, kind of like a broken checkerboard of his torso. In his dark eyes fought fury and shame. For years before, as a young man, he spent time in Holmesburg Prison, Philadelphia, where, to make a few bucks, he volunteered for a University of Pennsylvania medical study. He signed up for what was called the patch test, where tape and bandages were applied to his body with chemicals in them. The tapes would rip the flesh raw, and the wet bandages would be applied to this now open skin. Men like him would get $10, $15, $20, and $25 added to their books for commissary or postage costs. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of men, mostly black men, participated in these tests and thought little of it until years later. The pittance of money would be long gone, but the scars and patches of those days lasted for years. His name was Leotis Jones, and I'll never forget his words. "I can't even get with my woman, man. I can't let her see this stuff." Thousands of men from the 1950s to the 1970s, a true captive audience, participated in these experiments. Some went mad, others suffered for years. The project head, meanwhile, made millions of dollars, as did the university, from discoveries gleaned from these experiments. For example, have you ever heard of retinol A? It's a cosmetic used to erase wrinkles. It made Dr. Albert M. Kligman wealthy, as well as his partners. The poor fellows who contributed their skin, their health, their well-being got pennies and pain. Captives, capitalism, and exploitation. Perfect together, right? So, when I think of Black History Month, I think of those many men, grandfathers now, perhaps, scarred for life, tortured in some cases, so that others could profit from their suffering. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Sundiata Siddiq, gentle warrior. His name was Sundiata, and for over 40 years, he fought for the freedom of his people. Headquartered in Osning, New York, Sundiata worked in or led a number of groups working for black liberation and social justice. To list them all would exhaust our time, but just to mention a few, he chaired CORE in Rockland County back in 1968 and 69. In the 1970s, he chaired the Osning Black Liberation Front, and later, he led the NAACP's Osning chapter in suits against police brutality, and he helped spark the nation's first environmental racism suit against a notorious Osning waste transfer station. He shined not just as a leader, but as an organizer, working for freedom for political prisoners. His quiet, reassuring manner attracted younger activists who came to admire and respect Siddiq for how he invited them into the movement and taught them about struggles before their time. Sundiata Siddiq was, despite being a warrior for freedom, a truly gentle man. He talked to people with respect and dignity. He welcomed them. He cared about them, and they could feel it. MovesPAM Africa always spoke highly of him, And when she said, "That's a good brother," you could feel it, for he was. When I met him a few years ago, it seemed like we'd known each other for years. He was a kind, gentle, determined soul, and he loved his people. He was a freedom fighter who will be sorely missed by his partner, Deborah James, by his family, by his comrades, and by his people. Sundiata Sadiq, born 1st July 1955, returned to his ancestors on the 29th of January 2016. We shall not forget you. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today, and one we're going to be running right down to the wire on, all right? At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Joshua Oppenheimer. Josh is the director and writer of The Act of Killing, and most recently, The Look of Silence. The Look of Silence is now up for an Academy Award, and I had the chance to talk with Josh right after I returned from a Sundance Film Festival, and we dove into a lot of the questions posed by his film and life in general, the world in general today, all right? And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring you an interview I did with Brian Oakes. Brian is the director of a film called Jim, the James Foley story. And it's about the young journalist who was killed by ISIS, about a year and a half ago. And this film tells the story of Jim's life, why he did what he did in terms of being a journalist in conflict zones around the world, and why people need to know about him, all right? So this is an interview I did up at the Sundance Film Festival with Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis shortly after seeing the film. Claire is a journalist that worked with Jim in the Middle East. So check this out. All right, I'm sitting here with Brian Oakes, who's the director of a film I saw at Sundance called Jim, the James Foley story, and Claire Gillis, who's a journalist, who's in the Middle East with Jim for a number of times, I guess, right? People who don't know the Jim Foley story, Brian, why don't you tell people what that is?
Sure. James Foley was the first American journalist that was killed by ISIS in 2014. He was also a dear, dear friend of mine. I'd known him since we were 7 years old, growing up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, a small little rural town in New England. So it's a very personal story for me to take on.
What made you want to do this story, though? I mean, he's your friend, and he's a journalist, and he was killed. You weren't a filmmaker before you did this.
Yeah, I wasn't a filmmaker. I was in the film industry. My background is actually graphics and animation. And I've just recently had transitioned into directing over the last couple of years. It's my first film that I solo directed. My motivation for the film was, there's many reasons why I made the film, but my original motivation came out of about 2 or 3 months after Jim had been killed. I was just very uncomfortable with the way that the image of James Foley that we all have come to know, was being used in whether for political agendas or sensationalistic articles and information, potentially inaccurate stories. He became kind of more of an image than a person. And so I felt a responsibility to Jim and to family and friends of those of us who knew him and loved him that I wanted to show people and tell people who he was and what he was doing in Syria, which was very, very important stories as a journalist, as Claire can attest to. She's doing the same things. And in an effort to do that, to kind of recontextualize that image of Jim. So when you know who he was and you see where he came from, you see that image in a completely different way.
You know, one thing that really struck me is that when you did the film, you know, you could have easily been pulled in the direction of sort of just going into, I don't know, you know, the whole thing of like, okay, this was, and it was a heinous murder. But you could have concentrated on that alone and just told a story that was very one-dimensional. But you really chose to actually give people a fuller picture of this, including, I thought, the drive that he had around the work that he was doing. You know, because that's sort of, to me, that was the heart of what it was. I mean, people don't, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but you don't just go out in the world and throw everything on the line because you're bored.
Yeah. So Jim's death and his execution was not an intention to talk about in the film. I mean, it's obviously the end of his life, but it's insignificant in the sense of the bigger scope of what the film is about. What Jim was doing and what Claire and Manu Bravo, Nicole Tung, and Zach Bailey, who are the other journalists in the film, their work is extremely important for the world. I mean, I remember Nicole telling me there's a saying that conflict journalists, you know, who are on the front line, they're writing the first draft of history. And, you know, without these images and without these videos, we as a civilization don't know what's going on. And if we don't know what's going on, that can be a very dangerous world to live in. And so for Jim and his colleagues to be on the front lines, risking their lives to bring us these stories, is extremely important for the world to see. And in Jim's case, specifically what he was doing in Syria with the stories of the civilians, you know, these stories that he was telling are extremely relevant, maybe even more now so than when he was doing this 3 years ago, because of what we're seeing with the Syrian refugee crisis, which is the largest refugee crisis since World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Claire, let's talk about your experience with Jim. And I have a number of questions off this, but one of the things is, and you're featured prominently in the film, and you know, you spent a lot of time in the same parts of the world as he did, doing the same thing. And there's always this question that I've noticed just in reading even what people are saying about the film and listening to people after it. There's still always this question that I think, Ryan, you started to speak to, but I think there's still a lot more there. People keep posing this question of, why are you doing this? His family posed it throughout the entire thing. Why the hell is he going back there? You know, but there's something more than just sort of like being amped up on the need for, you know, constant tension and danger and all this stuff. There's something, I think, much deeper that goes into being a conflict journalist, being a journalist in general, generally, if you're doing anything that means anything, than being a conflict journalist, which is one of the most difficult things I think there is to be in journalism.
When you see a situation where you see literally millions of refugees streaming across a border, maybe with a suitcase, maybe with shoes, maybe without shoes, there's an obvious humanitarian imperative to take care of these people. And for some of us, our first question is like, wow, they're really running away fast. What could be so bad? What's actually happening there? We need to understand that better. As Brian just mentioned, the refugee crisis, I think it's essential at times like this, when you have a potential presidential candidate who wants to ban Muslims from entering the country, what are these people running away from? They're running away from hell. They're leaving hell. And we know that. Why? Because of the work that Jim has done, because of the work that all of our colleagues have done to document what's happening inside that country. The people who run into a burning building versus the people who run out of a burning building, that's a kind of fundamental personality thing. I think you can't really ever explain to someone else why you feel the way you feel. But when you have that curiosity and you're able to live it out, it's incredibly, incredibly powerful to be in a position where you can actually see what's going on, and then you really understand a little bit better. I mean, look at, you know, people getting on these tiny little rafts that don't even, you know, you wouldn't smuggle liquor in that thing and try to get across the sea. The risk of death is so high. What makes someone want to do that? I want to know. I want to know what's so bad that makes that the better option.
Claire had a really amazing story that we unfortunately could not fit into the film. I had to, you obviously have to choose your stories, and maybe she can tell it now. Was the story when you were with the Libyan rebel in the desert who you were talking to and ran off. And it's a really powerful story. Yeah.
So this is in the very early days of the conflict in Libya, and it was before NATO had become involved, so before the airstrike started. And Gaddafi's warplanes were still carrying out airstrikes. So I was down at the front lines one day, and, you know, with a number of other journalists, and we were with rebels, and we heard an airplane start circling overhead, and we all kind of started running. You don't know where to run. There's nowhere to run. Like, it's not logical. You're in the middle of the desert. It could hit you at any point. You just feel like you want to run. And one of the young men who I was talking to, he and I were just chatting. He was like, yeah, you know, I've got this, like, three-week-old daughter who I've barely seen, and my wife, and I don't know what comes next. And I asked him, you know, how long have you been doing this? And he's like, I don't know, a week, 10 days. Well, time doesn't mean anything for us anymore. And we have nowhere to go but forward. And then the plane started circling again, and we ran in different directions. And that was the last I saw of him.
Wow. You know, one thing, when I was talking earlier, that you reminded me of when you said that you didn't want to have this, like, sort of exploitative thing going on. And to me, it's really interesting, because the way you did the film and not having the beheading and the aftermath, the gruesome aftermath of that, and making a conscious decision that that wasn't going to be on there. And it struck me as I'm watching the film and listening to you talk afterwards, the idea that this could have gone two ways. This could have been a jingoistic, and like you were saying earlier, that it could have been anything. It could have been people, you know, this rallying cry for war, send more troops to the Middle East, anything. And it's been done. We've seen it done many, many times over and over again, where these things that happen to people who are doing basically objectively very good things and are consciously doing it because they want to do that, then everything that their life has been about gets turned around. And I really admired you not including that gruesome footage, because not only because it just, you didn't want to reduce his life to that, but it also raised some bigger questions, I think, in terms of what are you putting forward in terms of what a person's life is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was never my intention to use that again. It's not a part of the story of Jim, and yeah, it's pretty simple. I would never, you know, never would have any reason to use that.
And journalists immediately, once the footage was made public, there was an immediate backlash against any outlet that did publish that image or those videos. Mm-hmm. And it was a fairly universal decision to just use the images of Jim in the field at work, and not this, you know, final act.
I think the other thing is that another reason, other than the main one, but what you can access on the internet now is extremely powerful and graphic imagery, especially now that we've seen videos from jihadist groups, and not only jihadist groups, but videos from American kids uploading things. I mean, it's just the Wild West. And we have a choice, an individual choice, of whether or not we want to watch that. And I'm not going to show something that's graphic or controversial and take that choice away from someone who might choose to watch this film. So it's just kind of it does raise the question of responsibility of when you watch something or when you choose to watch something on the internet or on television, I think we have a responsibility to understand where that is coming from, who's behind the camera of that footage or of that photograph, and understanding where that is coming from and what is the intention of it. Because I think once you're able to at least understand the perspective of a piece of media or a piece of news, I think that's really important for understanding what's real and what's not. And making decisions about what you choose to believe.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis. Brian is the director of the film Jim, The James Foley Story, which tells the story of the life and murder of journalist Jim Foley. And Claire Gillis is a journalist who worked with Jim during that time. Claire, let me ask you this. I kept thinking, and you, Brian, you included this in your film, the Nick Ott photo of the woman, the young girl running down the street on fire in Vietnam, which was, you know, again, that was showing something that was really horrific and needed to be shown.
And I kept thinking about this in relation to some things you were saying, and I think you were saying too, that this is what Jim Foley's life was actually about, was actually bringing knowledge to people about what was true and what wasn't true, what was happening to people, and in a certain sense, opening a door for people to find out why it was happening, and giving people what they needed to really analyze the world and to do something. So I wanted to ask you about that in relation to Jim and in relation to yourself.
Okay, and what was the question exactly?
Come on. Well, just this idea, this point about, you know, people are doing this because they want to bring truth out.
Yes.
They really want to bring truth out. And it seems like it trumps everything, which I think it should. You want people to know about this. And so you have Jim Foley, who, in fact, I think actually it was quoted somewhere, it says, and I don't know whether you said this, but that he would not want to be the story. And was it you?
That may well have been me. Oh. And that's a standard thing that journalists say. Mm-hmm. You write the story, you tell the story, you do not want to be the story. And Jim, yeah, he would have been very disturbed to know that his death had turned into a propaganda tool, had turned into the topic of conversation when it comes to Syria. This was ISIS's kind of, I don't know, announcement, coming out party, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
I think that the historical photos from, you know, the Normandy and the Vietnam, my intention of showing those was actually during Manu Bravo, who's a photojournalist and colleague of Claire and Jim's. And he's talking about how what he does matters. And he doesn't do it for $300 a day. He doesn't do it for the money. He does it because it's transcendental for him. And when he's at the end of his life, he wants to know that he's done something for society. And that's, to me, like, that's a very historical point of view. And so he might be taking photos in Syria, but what he's doing has been happening for decades throughout war. When you're trying to answer the question of, like, why is he going back in there? Journalists have been going back in there for centuries. Conflict journalism has existed, and that's how we have images of World War II. And that's, they're writing history, they're documenting history. And so, of course, they're going to go back in there because that's the job and that's what's important. It's not anything new. We've been doing it. It's changed. The landscape has changed.
But you know what's interesting? Is that today, the ability of people like yourself, Claire, to do this is getting smaller and smaller. I mean, you can go and do it, but the point was made many times in the film is that you're actually living on shoe leather in terms of being able to even survive, not because of the danger, but also because of, look, this is a society that does manufactured news. We know all about Trump and every other, you know, political, Republican political candidate, the Democratic Party's political candidate, what each argument is. And then we know a certain picture of what's happening in places like the Middle East, you know, what's happening in places like Africa. But that picture is filtered through all these journalists who, when I was in South Africa, it was very, very heavy. Most of the journalists that were supposed to be covering these uprisings, they would sit in the bar in Johannesburg and they would pay kids to come in and tell them what happened in the townships these days. And these kids were smart because they said, we don't have to go out to the townships. We can all get paid. We just go in and we all tell them the same thing and they give us the money, you know. But the journalists were putting that out as news. And then it was also shaped by their own political conceptions of what should be the news, which I thought what you brought out in the film and what you lived and what Jim lived and the rest of the people that were with you was something that was diametrically opposed to that kind of stand on journalism. And I think that's critical and very needed in the world today.
It's very needed in the world today, and it is profoundly and disastrously underfunded. And one of the main things that I think the movie gets across, one of the main issues that the Foley Legacy Foundation addresses, is the need to support freelancers adequately as we work in these areas. Because if you don't have enough money to take care of your basic safety needs, like buy a flak jacket, hire a reliable fixer translator, stay in a hotel that's safe, then you put yourself at risk by working on that kind of a shoestring budget.
I would add to that, and I think also there is a need for socially people to actually to have that social, that societal support for people that are doing this work that actually says, look, this is journalism, and this needs to be done. If we don't have this, we really don't know what the hell is happening in the world. We have to take this sort of manufactured news as like the best we can do.
Yeah, or just, you know, have a few interviews on Skype with someone inside Syria. And this is legitimately some of the best ways that we can get news from inside Syria at this point in time, is Skype interviews with trusted contacts, because the number of journalists on the ground there now is just minuscule, because it's become far too dangerous.
We have time for, I think, one more question, because I'm looking at it's almost 20 minutes, and we'll sneak a couple of extra ones. You told this story by weaving together three stories. And, I mean, you had the part with the people that were in prison with him the last time he was in prison. You had the part with the people like Claire and others who were active in the field with him. And then you had the family and friends. And what was your intention in bringing, I mean, it seems like a simple question, because I know it does create the full person, but it seems like it's really important, because you didn't lose what's actually the main thread. And I say that having thought of, I heard Haskell Wexler play an interview he did with Jim in some demonstration in Chicago a number of years ago.
It was the NATO.
Right. And I thought that was really remarkable, actually, you know, because Haskell was an irascible guy. He basically got there, and he said, look, I want people to know that it's not what's being said about Jim. This isn't what he was about. I did this interview, and this actually tells you more about what his soul was about, what his heart was about. And I thought that that's some of what you managed to do by interweaving these three stories, but never losing that main thread of what his life was about.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think, but I mean, that's not a testament to my storytelling. I mean, that was Jim. I mean, Jim did not change his characteristics through anybody, with his family and his colleagues, his friends, and ultimately in captivity, what we discovered. All of the values that he had, and then all the characteristic traits that he had, he carried into any situation that he had. I mean, he was a teacher for Teach for America in Phoenix, Arizona, and then he taught in the Chicago prison systems in Cook County boot camp. He was history and literature, and we learned that he gave literature lectures in captivity. He was a mentor to his students, and obviously we found out through talking to his former hostages that he was a big support system, one of the pillars of that the 19 hostages in that system. So what I learned about Jim actually was not, what I learned about Jim during those 2 years of captivity was not surprising at all, because it was just a carrying over of everything that I knew about him already. And so it's nicely woven between family and colleagues and friends and former hostages, because all of Jim's characteristics kind of complete everybody, you know, in that world. So,
you know, one thing in relation to that, I think it's, and this will be for you the last question, I guess, but, and it's probably two parts, but it's, you know, the one thing coming off of that is that also what came out of that and all the things that went to make him up, then you'd step back and you look at what he's doing with his journalism. And it's true, you don't go into something, even if you have a side. I mean, like I told you, I've reported for a long time, and I know I have a side generally, but I don't allow that to determine the truth of what's going on. You have to look for truth in what's actually happening. You have to understand that. But I thought that actually the thing that oftentimes gets lost when we talk about people like Jim, or when not enough people who actually understand it deeply talk about it, but the fact that I think it came out a couple times in the film, where he wanted the people here to even understand the relationship between what this country does in the Middle East, you know, and how that gives rise to, even frankly, I think even in something like ISIS, you know, it's a reaction to some stuff that, not some specific policy, but decades long, you know, savaging of the Middle East. And of course, people are going to rise up. Now, they rise up and take up really reactionary things a lot of times. Sometimes they don't. But let's talk about that a little bit. The idea of actually, there's a humanitarian aspect to what you're doing, but there's also something about wanting the truth and actually then not being afraid to say, look, we want the people here that is our audience to understand even the relationship between what the U.S. does in this place and what's happening in this place. Because that's a big part of the truth that gets covered up by things like the mainstream press that's just sort of, it's all... You can read every major paper in the U.S. today, and every front page is pretty much 95% the exact same story. So what about that in terms of that, you know, what that means for people, you know, like yourself, you want to, you know, you don't just go in and say, I'm going to report on what I, whatever. You actually have something urging you on of what you want to bring out. And I thought in Jim's case, it was actually what came out to me in the film was actually the idea that he did want the truth, and he wanted the truth no matter where it went, including pointing out this stuff about this country does some pretty damn bad things around the world, and he was going to reveal that.
Exactly, and he spent time in Iraq as well. So I think his understanding of, for example, U.S. actions in Iraq and how they affected subsequent developments in that country and in Syria, obviously, I think it informed him deeply. And his focus was, in most cases, just on the civilian tragedies. And so much of what gets filmed and photographed is the sort of frontline bang-bang, guys shooting at each other, something on fire, somebody running. And that fully obscures the fact that 90 to 95% of any casualties in any war are civilians. And it ruins their lives. I mean, it ruins their lives either because it ends it or because it destroys the fabric of the society. And Jim had a really keen sense of that.
All right. Thank you very much. And Claire Gillis, really glad I got a chance to speak to you today.
Thank you.
Brian Oakes, I want to ask you one more question. When the hell is this thing going to air, man?
Well, we got lucky. HBO is distributing the film, and they're going to air it on February 6th on HBO. And, of course, after that, plug into HBO Go, and you can watch it whenever you want.
There you go. And you should, okay? All right, Brian,
thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Okay.
All right. That was an interview I did at Sundance Film Festival with Brian Oakes, the director of the film Jim, the James Foley story, and Claire Gillis, one of the journalists that worked with Jim Foley in the Middle East. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with my conversation with Joshua Oppenheimer. So stay tuned. Welcome back. Now we're going to be listening to an interview I did with Joshua Oppenheimer about his film, The Look of Silence. And that film is up for an Academy Award this year. I had a chance to hear Josh up at the Sundance Film Festival and interview him a short time after we returned. And this is our conversation about all the big questions posed coming off of his film, The Look of Silence. So check this out. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. We got limited time, and I got 1,000 questions, so I'm going to jump into it right now. The first thing I want to talk about is your two Hallmark films, The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. Both films that were stunning in an eerie way. They were really beautiful. They were also very powerful and really kind of, they captured so much that was, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of like so much that was sort of like the bottom of society in a certain sense. The worst that it could get, the monstrous killings of what, almost 1 million people in Indonesia, people who were communists, who were activists, who were just swept up in even people seeking revenge or whatever. And you turned them into something that people could look at and be both amazed by but also horrified by. I want to ask you two things. One, what compelled you to actually dig into those two subjects?
Well, I think what really compelled me was the sense that the perpetrators are still in power and not facing justice. And as a consequence, they've never been forced to admit what they've done was wrong. And so instead of perpetrators that I've seen in other films or that I expected to confront when I first met these men, instead of denying what they'd done or acting ashamed about it, they boasted. And they at least pretended to be proud, maybe tried to convince themselves that they were proud. And that sense that here was this very recognizably human nexus of trauma and guilt, certainly, because they are, all of the perpetrators, in fact, are human, even if we want to sort of say they're not, on the one hand, and self-deception, lies, stories, ways of talking that glorify and elevate what they've done into something heroic in their minds, offered for me this kind of glimpse into something that I felt was a very profound and simple truth about human evil, which is that the capacity for human evil depends on our ability to lie to ourselves. And I think, in fact, what's disturbing about the films is not that they kind of, as you said, take us to the bottom of humanity, not that they take us to the worst kinds of people, these most shocking crimes, because we're inundated with stories of shocking crimes and awful things happening all over the world. If the films are powerful, it's because even if there's new information in them, because we didn't know about this genocide or we didn't know about this particular political situation of the impunity of the perpetrators in Indonesia, that actually there's a very deep recognition in the impunity, in the self-deception of the perpetrators. So it was really in recognition of that, something universal in this situation of impunity, this sense that maybe it's not the exception to the rule that the perpetrators win, but the rule itself across certainly most of the global South and in many ways the United States too, that led me to spend all these years focusing on this. It was the sense that impunity, which is really what my films are about, might just be the story of our times.
What do you mean your films are about impunity?
Well, I think it's easy to see the films and say, because they challenge you and they provoke you and they make you think a lot of things and you don't necessarily have a ready summary for them, it's easy to say, oh, these are about a genocide in Indonesia 50 years ago. But then you get the sense that they're about the past. They're historical documentaries. They're not. The act of killing is about what happens when perpetrators win and remain in power for decades and are able to write the history celebrating what they've done so that they never have to confront the real meaning of what they've done, what it means for the society, for themselves. And then what happens when a whole society is built on the basis of lies, on what corruption becomes inevitable, what thuggery becomes inevitable, how are boastful stories of the killings told by the perpetrators used to keep everyone afraid and therefore silent and quiescent in the face of massive plunder? That's about today. That's about impunity today and about a regime of fear built on impunity today, something that we have in every American city, that we feel in all sorts of ways in our own society. And the second film is sort of the reverse shot of the first. In a way, it's asking, what is it like, what does it do for human beings, ordinary human beings, for the survivors, for the relatives of the victims, to have to live in such a regime ruled over by the perpetrators in the shadow of the men who killed their loved ones? What does it do to us to have to live for 50 years afraid and silent? Again, a story about what it's like to live in a regime of total impunity today. And it's in that sense that the two films are about the present and not about what happened 50 years ago. If they're about the genocide, it's only because in a terrible way, when there's impunity, genocide doesn't end. Because although the killings may stop, people's lives are still being destroyed by fear. And your first question was how I got into this, and I answered it in a kind of abstract way, but very concretely. I first went to Indonesia in 2001 to teach a group of plantation workers how to make a film in which they would document their struggle to organize a union in the aftermath of the Suharto dictatorship, under which unions were illegal and which came to power through the genocide. And I was on this Belgian-owned oil palm plantation, and the Belgian company made the women workers do the supposedly easy work of spraying the pesticides and the herbicides, but they weren't given any protective clothing, and the women were dying of liver failure in their 40s. And one of the first things that the workers did as a fledgling union was to demand protective clothing, and the company responded by hiring this paramilitary group called Pancasila Youth to threaten and attack the workers. And the workers immediately dropped their demands, explaining to me, though this is a matter of life and death for us, our parents and grandparents were killed by this organization, which was in 1965 working for the army and carried out a mass killing of all the union members in this area and across the country, we think. They didn't know exactly what happened nationally. That was really the first I'd heard of the genocide. But more importantly, it was the moment when I realized what was killing these women was not only poison, but fear, and fear today.
You know, it's very heavy because when you think about this, you've also made a point that when you do your films and when you look into this, on one level, you're telling a story. But on another level, you have a really deep commitment to exposing lies for what they are, is the way you put it. Let's talk about that a little, because what's the importance of that? And what do you mean, exposing lies for what they are? And what impact does that have?
I think that in any system of power, you have those in power telling stories, writing the history, creating patriotic rituals that make whatever the situation is that the powerful, and from which inevitably the powerful profit, that's why they're in power, these stories make whatever that situation is feel natural, almost immutable, like the natural order of things. And whereas, in fact, of course, the situation is anything but natural. And if the situation, if the gross injustices and power imbalances that you have in Indonesia feel natural and immutable, then it feels like it's pointless to try and change them. How can you change it? This is the way the world is and should be. And so it is very powerful. It is powerful to provide an alternative account, to say, well, actually, the official history says this, but in fact, this happened. But it's even more powerful if, at the same time, you can show how the official history is constructed, so that you never hear it the same way again. It never works the same way again. That's why there's this very important moment in The Act of Killing, which I think is really why all of the perpetrators panic in the look of silence when confronted by a survivor. It's a very powerful moment when one of the death squad leaders says to another, if we succeed in making this film, it will show the world that all of the propaganda's a lie, that what we did was wrong, and that, in fact, the victims of the genocide were innocent. And there was this dawning awareness that by creating these dramatizations in The Act of Killing, where they're, in a sense, reenacting or going through the motions of creating the lies, the architecture of the lies, the structure of the lies was being exposed. This sounds abstract and complicated because I'm not putting it well, but I suppose a very simple example that we all know is the emperor's new clothes. The child comes in and says, look, the king is naked. And he doesn't just call attention to the truth, which would probably not have much effect. What he's doing is, by calling attention to the truth in that way, in that context, he's actually, and what makes his intervention so impactful, he's calling attention to the fact that everyone's been lying to themselves and they can no longer do it anymore. They can no longer repeat the lie without it getting stuck in their throat. And so everything changes, or can change, if you can not only provide a more truthful account or an alternative account, but also show how the stories that the powerful have told to justify, to naturalize their power, are in fact created.
What does that have to do with what you were talking about with Werner Herzog about the shock of recognition?
Well, I think that maybe the role of the artist is a little bit like that child in The Emperor's New Clothes, in the sense that even if an artist comes and tells a story or provides information that no one knew about before, and I sort of alluded to this a moment ago, if you tell a story about a genocide you hadn't heard of or a country you hadn't heard of or a phenomenon you didn't know about, or just a fictional story with new characters, what will make the story impactful, what makes it powerful, is never the new information. Oh, I didn't know that. That might make it interesting. But new information that doesn't fit into a pattern, you just kind of jettison it. It's hardly even interesting. What makes it impactful and powerful is not the new story. Oh, I didn't know this story. This is important. What makes it powerful and impactful is the recognition, the way that the story confirms something that you knew, that you already knew, but had maybe been too afraid or too uncomfortable to talk about or had no words for. So like the child in The Emperor's New Clothes who points at something everyone knew, look, the king is naked. Mm-hmm. It's powerful because of the recognition of truth. And we may, as nonfiction filmmakers, go out into the world and discover new stories and bring them to light, but that's not what makes our work powerful. What makes it powerful is the resonance with mm-hmm. deep truths that we've been afraid to acknowledge, or worse, that we've lied to ourselves, pretended to ourselves, like the people in the story of The Emperor's New Clothes. We've lied to ourselves by pretending that we didn't know.
So the shock of recognition actually is a positive thing in terms of people being able to, one, just understand what's happened or really put it together fully in their heads, but also then able to act in relation to that.
Oh, it's essential, because you cannot solve a problem, you cannot address a problem you're too afraid even to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, why don't people acknowledge the problems that, first of all, at some level they already know, and second of all, they pose us enormous challenges, sometimes even to our very survival. And if we don't acknowledge them, the consequences could be dire indeed. I'm talking about continuing with our present carbon economy, even though we know the abyss into which it's leading us. Why don't we acknowledge those problems? And I think fear is a big part of it. In the case of the perpetrators in my films, fear of guilt is a big part of it. If the perpetrators were to acknowledge really the simple fact of what they'd done, how would they live with themselves? And for the survivors, how would they go about a life, building a family, continuing to raise their children amidst the awareness that all around them are the people who killed them and could kill them again?
And, you know, the thing is, though, is I keep thinking about this because it's sort of like once you know, I mean, look, what happened in Indonesia was monstrous. And we see it, similar things happening on smaller scales, sometimes approaching the same thing. We've seen it in various countries in Africa. We've seen it. We've seen what the U.S. has done in the Middle East and what it's giving rise to and all this and the terrible suffering in the world. And that if people actually, if there is this sort of recognition of things, if there's a recognition of what actually, what's really happening and who's responsible, it does seem to me that there's a point where it's not just that you can understand a thing, but we really need, look, for me, in the world today, we need some people who are going to stand up and say, no more, we can't go this way. But that requires having access to the kind of things that you're putting forward. That's what really struck me about this thing about the shock of recognition, the idea of actually being able to move into this. So, I mean, it was very heavy to me to think about that, because without that understanding, without the understanding of what's real and what isn't, what's a lie and what isn't, we can live our entire life following a lie. And all it takes is one moment for that lie to crack open, to break, to be exposed. And things can change dramatically. And that's what really struck me about what, because I watched both of your films a number of times and I kept thinking, all right, this is some heavy stuff. Even watching the one relative in The Look of Silence, the uncle who was responsible for actually
sending out all the prisoners to be killed.
Including his
own nephew.
Yeah. And when that happens, when that breaks open, there's a certain thing that, yes, there's anguish in a certain part that I imagine his family feeling like anguish, but then also there's a certain opening that once people know the truth, that they can actually then refashion their thinking and move to change things.
Well, yes. And in The Look of Silence, actually, it's an important example, because what's really powerful about the scene with the uncle is, first of all, that Adi, who loved his uncle, the main character, didn't know his uncle's role. But then in the next scene, you get the feeling that Adi's mother, who we love very much, she's one of the great characters in the film, that she did know, and that she couldn't allow herself to know it. She knew it, but had to pretend or convince herself or make herself feel that she didn't know it. And Adi and I really discussed, should you not tell this story to your mother? What if it's too much for her? And he said, no, it's so important. She has put all her hopes in me as being a kind of reincarnation of my dead brother. And I cannot betray that by continuing to support the lies which have actually created the kind of, almost like the padded cell walls in this prison of silence. Yes, the lies make it easier. And again we hear the survivors say, let the past be past. But Adi never accepts that, because he recognizes that they're saying it out of fear. Just as the perpetrators, when they say let the past be past, are saying it as a threat, suggesting that the past isn't there. It's a gaping wound in the present from which everyone is looking away, and that it'll never heal until everyone turns around, looks at it, addresses it, and says, okay, this is what happened. How shall we live together? And I think that it's exactly that that embodies the sense that we need to not just say, look at all these terrible things that are happening, but actually make an audience recognize the myriad ways in which all the time we're lying to ourselves to make our world easier, and also make the audience feel what the terrible consequences of those lies are.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Oppenheimer. Josh is the writer-director of the film The Look of Silence, the follow-up to his original film, The Act of Killing. Both films tell the story of the Indonesian government's slaughter of up to a million Indonesian revolutionaries and progressive people back in the 1960s. Now, I want to move on to another section, because you also make a big point, and I know you made it in your discussions with Werner Herzog at Sundance, but you've made it elsewhere too, this point about the need to distinguish documentary filmmaking from journalism. Because, like, if people look at your films, there's a pull to say, he went in, he's playing the role of a journalist who's actually using this form of documentary film. But actually, you argue that there's a difference between, and it's important that people recognize that, a difference between documentary filmmaking and journalism. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think I want to maybe soften the difference, because I really do feel, out of deference to great journalism, that great journalists actually, in the way they craft their stories, are creating works of art. And create works of art that touch us, again, because they take us beyond the presenting of new information into this moment of recognition where we see ourselves in the story, where we feel this is us. where the story is not a window onto a far off or remote or new phenomenon that we didn't know about before, but a mirror in which we're confronting ourselves. So I think great journalists can be and often are artists. But journalism in the first instance has to concern itself with going out and getting that information that's new, recontextualizing it so that it can be put to use in the service of some public good, ideally at least. That's what journalism should be. And in that sense, if it has, I feel like it has to, at the first instance, shock us with the new. It has to somehow take this new information and shock us into saying, well, this is inconsistent with the values that we have or that I have, and we have to do something about this. Whereas the role of the artist is somehow, first and foremost, this thing we talked about a moment ago, the shock of recognition, is to deliver a shock of the familiar. That uncanny sense of recognition where you feel, oh yes, or rather, oh no, that's really me, isn't it? It's not so much that journalism and nonfiction film are opposed to each other. If someone says my films are works of journalism, I'm comfortable with that. But my first commitment is to creating that experience of recognition long before it's about looking for the important story that the world didn't know about.
What I wanted to ask you is this point again around the relationship between journalism and, look, I spent my life as a journalist, right? And actually a literary journalist in terms of even, you know, I traveled through South Africa when the rebellions were going on and wrote stories that were actually beautiful stories that also laid bare some things, both positive and negative in terms of what was going on among the people, but also the regime and everything that was being carried out there. And I've done that in many other places, many other subjects and whatnot. But I recognize in your film, for instance, there's a difference between someone who would be writing a story. And again, it's not that clear when it comes to literary journalism and the art form of documentary filmmaking. And the thing is that documentary filmmaking is an art. And it's an art. It's actually, it's not like, oh, well, it's sort of the newspaper of the artistic world or something. It's actually something that has to, again, I kept thinking the image you have of the guy wearing the...
The four-opter.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible. To this day, I think of that. It pops up in my head. It's always there. Because it just concentrated something about everything you were doing in terms of looking into things, in terms of just the layers between the person and reality. It just really struck me as that, and every time I see it, I get something new out of it. And that seems to have something to do with documentary filmmaking. You actually can use different things to bring the truth to people than you do when you're doing journalism. Journalism, you really do have to be rooted in right now. You have to, everything almost has to be right there. Well, you can use imagery and whatnot, but you still don't have that freedom to, or the necessity to, practice this as an art form.
Well, I think that what I'm trying to do is not to report what happened while I was shooting the film, certainly, and also not to report what I discovered, what important information I learned while shooting the film, which might lead to a journalistic or historical approach where I'm saying this is what I learned happened in 1965 and these are the conditions the survivors are living under ever since and these are the conditions of the perpetrators who live around them with impunity. But rather to try and explore how the human beings involved with this situation live with this situation, cope with this situation. What is the lived experience? What is the phenomenon? What is the feeling like for a family that lives for 50 years surrounded by all the men who killed their son, unable to talk about it? It's not the fact of that I want to report. It's that I want the audience to be immersed in that family, to feel what – I want you to feel like you are Adi or your brother's Adi and his parents are your parents or your grandparents. His children or your grandchildren. And I want you to feel that in your body, in your stomach, in your – and for that, of course, one uses metaphor, and a metaphor in film – and in any art, I think, should always have a kind of enduring mystery. Otherwise, it's merely a symbol. It should never be fully explicable. And I think the shot of the eyes that you talk about with the red glasses framing them is maybe one of the metaphors in the film. And in this case, I'd say sort of roughly it's a metaphor for blindness. Mm-hmm. But it is also somehow, it is still inexplicable. It still bears a mystery, in part because there's all this behind Enong, the perpetrator's blind eyes, is all this kind of, is this uncertainty and this danger and this fear and this anger. And I feel that what I try to do while shooting is to take a long journey with participants, a very intimate journey that hopefully will transform all of us, not just them, but me too, where again and again, we create situations together where we're all pushed beyond our comfort zone in order to reveal the most important human truths, by which I mean the feelings that human beings have in such situations, allowing us to understand how humans create these situations within the overall safe space of making the film. And then I try to, in the editing, not, as mentioned earlier, not to report on what happened, but to condense, to distill whatever I discovered on this journey into a kind of poetic and immersive experience for the audience.
Now, you've also talked a lot about journalism that pretends to understand but really seeks only to condemn.
Yeah, I think that there's a kind of narrative framework, particularly in American storytelling, but it's certainly worldwide, where we divide the world into good guys and bad guys. Because of that, it can feel natural enough to just compile lists of crimes, compile lists of wrongdoings, name them, make it clear that we think they're wrong, and condemn them, and pretend that we've dealt with it, pretend that we've somehow analyzed, understood, figured out how and why this can happen. And there's this confusion of condemnation for comprehension. It's as though condemnation has such a kind of moral force, it kind of creates this kind of illusion of deliverance or expiation, just to have named and condemned, that we forget that we haven't actually understood anything by doing that. It's all based on this falsehood that the world is divided into good guys and bad guys, what I think of as the Star Wars morality. And if we could acknowledge that that's a lie, and that in reality, the human being is immensely complex, and there's not even a good part and a bad part. Sometimes the good part, the part, can be involved in the practice of evil. For example, in the perpetrators in Indonesia, it's because the perpetrators feel guilty and are desperate and afraid of their guilt, and therefore desperate not to admit it, that they boast and continue insisting on the victor's history and on the heroism of what they did. It's out of guilt that they do that. So it's out of their knowledge that what they did was wrong.
I know what you're saying, but there's also, in the world, there are people who are running things. There are people who, the people who ran Indonesia, who are running it today. You know, there's people who, when they committed that genocide, it wasn't a mistake. It was very well thought out in a certain sense. And they did that, I think, there's a compulsion on their part. It's not that they feel guilty, even if they do feel guilty. But you look at those two guys that were centerpieces in The Look of Silence that went down to the river and laughingly told the stories about the bodies and what they did to people before they threw them into the river and all this. And you're thinking, okay, what motivated them? And in a sense, there is a bigger thing going on about that genocide. In a lot of ways, was rooted in the need for that regime to establish itself in power.
Absolutely. What motivated people was the need for power and was a desire for power and wealth and prestige and position. And that goes all the way up to the Johnson administration. There's a clip in The Look of Silence where we learn that Goodyear was harvesting the rubber that goes into its tires and into condoms using slaves drawn from death camps, which is what German corporations were doing only 20 years earlier at Auschwitz. And this should give all of us pause and lead all of us to question, to what extent might American involvement, American support, American participation in this genocide not really have been motivated by ideological anti-communism, but rather, to what extent might ideological anti-communism have been an excuse, a pretext, just as the perpetrators have their excuses and pretexts, to justify what was really murderous corporate plunder, what was really a campaign of slaughter on behalf of their colleagues in business, on behalf of the men who make campaign contributions to them, on behalf of the companies from which the lawyers in the State Department and in the White House came just before the Johnson administration came to power. And so this revolving door between business and government in the United States is, of course, what I'm referring to. And my point is that, of course, there's venal motivations, but there's also self-deception, because no one, whether it's the people in the Johnson administration or the two men who go down to the river and are giving the thumbs up in the V for Victory where they killed, no one can live with the fact that they did that just out of greed. Mm-hmm. And I think that the perpetrators in The Look of Silence and in The Act of Killing, every single one of them lives their life in kind of manic flight from a cloud of guilt and shame that follows them everywhere they go. And by day, they outrun it. And at night, when they stop to sleep, it catches up to them and gets into their dreams and gives them nightmares. But because they've never been removed from power, they still have available a victor's history that celebrates what they've done. And so they do the human thing that you or I would do if you were in their positions. They take their bitter, rotten memories and they try to sugarcoat them in the sweet language of the victor's history. That is to say, they talk about it in heroic terms to justify what they've done. And you might think, well, why then do they talk about these awful things so happily? The cutting off of heads, the drinking of blood, the terrible details. It's precisely because those are exactly the bitter memories that they need to sugarcoat and make easier to swallow. And this, I think, is the only thing that accounts for why they relentlessly, compulsively boast about the most inappropriate details. If they were just psychopaths or monsters and mock sort of scheming demons, then they would know better than to boast about the awful stuff. They would say, yes, we were heroes and we exterminated the communists and that was wonderful, which is what the official history says. The official history is mute, written by the commanders of the genocide and their intellectual apologists. It's mute, it's silent about the actual killing. But the perpetrators, the actual executioners, don't have the luxury of being silent about the killing because they did it. And those memories haunt them. So they desperately try and take those bitter, rotten memories and sugarcoat them with this official history. And that's what accounts for the boasting. Mm-hmm.
So one more question. You've also said that you can't divorce great filmmaking from empathy. You're starting to speak to it now in terms of what you just said, but there seems to be something very important in terms of filmmaking itself concentrated in that statement.
Well, you asked me at the very beginning how I got into this, and I said, well, I felt when I encountered the boasting of the perpetrators that there was something unfathomable but important here. How can you understand this phenomenon? How can I understand this phenomenon? I can say, okay, the perpetrators are in power. This is a symptom of impunity. I can come to that conclusion pretty quickly. But then why are they boasting? And if I can see that the boasting is keeping everyone in the society afraid, so it's of profound political importance, it's the mechanism of a regime of fear, the question of, well, why are they boasting becomes all the more urgent. Mm-hmm. And to understand why a human being is boasting, we have to try and get into their head and empathize. And I know what it's like to boast. I sometimes do boast. I'm not proud of it. But when I do, I know it's never because I feel genuinely proud or happy with what I've done. It's always because I feel small and I'm trying to show others that I've done something important. It's like a little bird that puffs out its feathers to look bigger because it knows it's small. So this is just one example of how empathy works in filmmaking. My films, the whole questioning, the whole attempt to understand our human world by getting into the heads of the people who make our world, mm-hmm. That's really the project of important filmmaking, and that requires empathy. And I would say beyond that, that everything we talked about recognition, that the purpose of a great film ought to be, or is, if it's great, to shock the viewer through the recognition, through the familiar, not through the new, to make the viewer feel, oh no, yes, of course, that's me, but I hadn't realized it. Well, for that, the filmmaker has to bring the viewer very, very close to the people she's filming, and to make you feel what is it like to be that person. And the filmmaker also has to be very close to the audience and to empathize with what the audience will feel at every moment in the film, taking into account the fact that the audience is diverse and will come from all over the world and come from different backgrounds. And there has to be a trust that all human beings share something, and that no human being, no matter how demonic the things they've done, no human being's actually a demon beyond our understanding. And that may be an ideal, that might not be true 100% of the time, but I've taken that pretty far in my work. And I think that in that sense, empathy is the basis for everything we do, from the creation of characters to the creation of situations with nonfiction characters where you feel they will open up, to finding out how to photograph and edit those situations so the viewer is immersed in it and feels them in their skin. Empathy is the essential ingredient, I think, of filmmaking and art. And I think the problem is with, as I talked about it earlier, the Star Wars morality, no offense to George Lucas at the moment, but the problem with the Star Wars morality, of course, is that it's predicated on a failure of empathy. It's predicated on a willingness to say, okay, for dramatic expedience and to reassure the audience that it is good, we will empathize with these people who we will depict dishonestly. And we will not empathize and rather condemn and fail to comprehend these people who we will also depict dishonestly.
All right, Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, you've been listening to an interview I did with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer about his latest film, The Look of Silence. And The Look of Silence is the follow-up to his first film, which is The Act of Killing. And both of these films tell the story of the genocidal slaughter
by the Indonesian government against communists and other progressive people in Indonesia. We're talking about up to 1 million people dead for their political opposition to the Indonesian regime and U.S. imperialism. That brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis. I also want to thank Joshua Oppenheimer, and I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my intern, Alex Brenner. And again, thanking each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Blind eyes of justice.